Conference. Members, we are going to first hear from the department on the vehicle bill. Senate File 2074 is our vehicle. And we went through the provisions, the federal conformity provisions that are included in the omnibus bill. What we didn't talk about was the provisions that are not included. So I wanted to give the department a minute to talk about the provisions that are not included from Senate File 2074. Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Revenue, and Mark Peterson is here as well in case there's any more technical questions. He's much better able to answer those. As the Senator mentioned, we're really here talking about the second round of the federal conformity for the session, which has now contained many of those provisions in the omnibus tax bill. We we've been a strong advocate at the department for federal conformity in order to ease taxpayer burden for compliance, and we thank you for including federal conformity round two in your bill. Mark Hasty, as the chair mentioned, did discuss many of these items yesterday, so I will just highlight the differences between the Senate and governor's proposal as well as the items that are not conformed to. One of the provisions that are not being adopted in the Senate bill, which the governor did include in his recommendations, was a provision that allows the deduction from taxable income of up to $2,400 of unemployment compensation. The Senate bill does not conform to this, so this would be as an add-back to Minnesota income. Under current law, unemployment benefits are treated like other income and included in taxable income for estate purposes. The governor recommended conformity to this provision, and the cost carried in the governor's budget is a one-time cost of fiscal year 10 of $28.3 million, and it's estimated it would impact about 235,000 filers. Excuse me.
Is that, and Ms. Cadoon, that's in FY10?
Right. It's
only
a one-year cost. It just impacts calendar year 2009, which is in our fiscal year 10. Another provision that was adopted, recommended for adoption in the governor's budget, but was not included in the Senate, was dealing with Section 179. Section 179 deals with allowing a taxpayer to treat the cost of a qualifying business property purchase as an expense in the year that the property is placed in service rather than depreciating it over the life of the asset. The Senate does a recommendation that we've done in previous years, which would be, instead of allowing that immediate expense, it would be done as 80% add back, and then it is then deducted over the next 5 years. The governor recommended including full federal conformity for all the Section 179 law changes that the feds have done, not just this 2009 bill, but also in previous years, for property placed in service in 2009 and ongoing. The cost covered and carried in the governor's budget is $22.2 million, general fund cost for fiscal year 10 and 11, and then a general fund gain of $10.7 million in fiscal year 12 and 13. The ability of businesses to expense equipment purchases in the current calendar year was seen as important to encourage small businesses to invest in upgrading or expanding their operations in Minnesota and by reducing those costs in this immediate calendar year. The other provisions that were not included in the governor's recommendation nor in the Senate bill deal with, one was allowing a deduction of sales taxes for car purchases. This would be allowed for itemized deduction for individuals who choose to deduct state income taxes and as an additional standard deduction for non-itemizers. The cost, if we were to adopt this, was estimated to be $8.8 million in fiscal year 10. And impact about 97,000 filers. Another provision that had probably the largest cost in the bill, estimated cost to the state, was a cost dealing with the discharge of indebtedness. It had a cost of about $81 million. And this provision applied to businesses that buy back their own debt. And if they pay less than par and have a gain on the discharge of indebtedness, they would get to have a more immediate write-off of that. Those were the items that were not recommended in the Senate bill and a few in the governor's bill as well. I'd also just mention for the governor's proposal, which just dealt with Section 179, as well as the unemployment provision. When the governor put together his supplemental budget recommendation, the Department of Revenue was still trying to figure out some of the impacts of the federal stimulus bill. So the governor didn't have, for his consideration, some of those smaller dollar items, such as the net operating loss provision. And so he wasn't able to consider those for recommendation in his budget. My expectation, if he has that information, those are typically items that he has recommended conformity to in the past. So I would expect those smaller items. Okay. I would expect those smaller items that are recommended in the Senate version would be something the governor would be supportive of as well if it is in the final omnibus tax bill. With that, I'll conclude my testimony, and as I mentioned, Mark Peterson is here if there's any additional questions.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mark Peterson, attorney at the department. There's one other provision that was missed, and that's a bonus depreciation. There was another round of bonus depreciation that was enacted at the federal level, which gives taxpayers the ability to write off another 50% of the cost of assets in the year of a purchase. Under this proposal, and I think under the governor's proposal as well, this round of bonus depreciation would continue to be treated as other rounds have in the past, which would require the taxpayer to add back 80% of the additional depreciation and then write that off over the next 5 years.
And the cost, Mr. Peterson?
I think that's contained in their bill.
That's it. 5.6 million dollar gain in 2010 and 10.2 million in 2011.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Cadoon.
If I could just follow up, there was a question yesterday that we said we'd get back to you with a little more information on, which was regarding the capital equipment upfront exemption. And the question related to how much was with those who do not currently participate in the rebate program or the refund claim. And included in the estimate is participation, a very small adjustment for those who do not participate, which is roughly $3 to $4 million per year. So that was kind of the ongoing cost that's included in the revenue estimate. And most of the revenue loss is due to the delay in the refund claims, which may be submitted up to 3.5 years after the eligible proposal. So that goes through fiscal year 2013 under your revenue estimate.
Hey, Ms. Coon, so we carry an ongoing tail cost on it, and the reason is why? Because certain taxpayers don't submit a request for the refund. That's the reason it has an ongoing tail?
Yeah, what we currently experience is that most of the especially larger companies have the highest proportion of eligible purchases and who's have the larger refunds are the large companies who claim it. Obviously, small businesses do as well. There's a significant number of smaller businesses that don't claim the refunds for eligible purchases. Excuse me. And so it's that cost, that $3 to $4 million cost, is because those businesses that don't currently submit for the refund would now be eligible because it's no longer a refund situation. However, I also will mention that there's still an assumption that's even some of those small businesses especially, they'd still need to get an exemption certificate at the time of purchase, and some of those still probably won't participate just because of that fact.
So Ms. Cadoon, of businesses that make a capital purchase, is there, I realize the overwhelming amount of the money gets refunded back, mm-hmm. but do we know by business what percentage of businesses that are eligible don't actually apply?
I don't have that percentage with me. Like I said, the cost that they're estimated is $3 to $4 million.
But it is fair to say they're the smaller businesses that don't make the application for the refund.
I think that's fair to say, Mr. Chair.
Did we get that satisfactory answered for the committee? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to say that I'm hoping that the department will prepare to testify today about the property tax increases in the bill. There was an article in the St. Paul Pioneer Press this morning, and I know nobody here really believes everything that they read in the newspaper, but saying that this bill would result in $886 million in property tax increases, and that was compared to the governor's, which they said was more favorable. So I'm hoping that the department will either testify now or at some point before we adjourn our meeting, Mr. Chair, so we can get full testimony about that.
Senator Ortman, I think that's a good idea, and I think it's best to wait until the bill is amended, because I think the bill is going to change a little bit from where it was yesterday. So the testimony would be more relevant after it's amended.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, Ms. Cadoon.
Thank you.
Members, Senate File 2074 is in front of us. Any discussion before we go to amendments? And I think we'll wait with the public testimony. We'll give you an opportunity to, if anybody wants to testify on specific amendments, an opportunity to do that. But then if we could withhold testimony on provisions in the bill, we'd like to do that after the bill is all marked up, because it's going to change some as amendments get put on. Anybody have an amendment? Well, I guess there's an author's amendment. Let's take that. I guess it's coming up in a couple minutes. It's pretty extensive. What I've learned is the tax chair is, when you put the bill out the day before, you find a lot of friends in the hours and evening before you mark the bill up the next morning. And I don't believe the House did it that way. I understand why, probably, now. But I do think putting it out yesterday and giving everybody an opportunity to look at it, come to me or come to other members with things they'd like to have considered, is the better process. So difficult as it was for many of the committee members and for staff in having to try to draft amendments today, and for those of you out there that are advocating for provisions that maybe aren't in or aren't totally in the way you'd like them, thanks for all your hard work over the last 24 hours. Let's take something smaller before we get to the author's amendment. Does anybody have something? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A2 amendment.
Senator Rest has the A2 amendment.
Do we have a current spreadsheet? Let's see if we have a current spreadsheet. Ask Susan. Susan here.
Sure.
This morning. Members, the situation we find ourselves in is yesterday in the bill, we included a provision that eliminates the income tax deduction for mortgage interest on second homes. So if you own a cabin and you have a mortgage under current law, you are able to deduct that interest when you itemize your taxes. We've talked about this with the Department of Revenue for a number of years. The Department of Revenue has never been able to put a number on that, to score that that expenditure. So in yesterday's spreadsheet, you saw that provision, and you saw a to be determined on the spreadsheet. The Department of Revenue came to us late yesterday afternoon or last night with a number of how much money that would score, and it is almost $70 million a year. So we have ourselves in a situation where coming into committee this morning, we do have some additional money because of that new information on the spreadsheet. So Senator Rest came to me and said, considering we now have some additional money, she has a provision contained in one of her larger bills that we heard earlier in this session on the pass-through of business income. And it's, I think, a very good provision. I think a provision the committee was very interested in. And it now appears like we could include that provision she had in her reform bill and still be in the positive territory on the spreadsheet. So having said that, members, that's where the money came from, and it's a provision that the business community should be very, very interested in. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I am very, very pleased to be able to offer the A2 amendment, which was a recommendation that from the Governor's Tax Study Commission that I included in the reform bill that I had, not to the extent that the Tax Study Commission recommended it. They recommended a 20% deduction of pass-through income from partnerships and LLCs and S-corps, et cetera. But it is included here at 10% for the next 3 years. And Senator Bach spoke yesterday about how this bill is certainly a bill that is a revenue raiser and that intends to go honestly about giving revenues to the state in order to meet our needs during this period of economic collapse, but that it's also a jobs bill. And we need to be given incentives to businesses to reinforce the positive benefits of doing business here in Minnesota. We have in the bill another major provision that was in my reform bill that almost I don't know of anybody that opposes it, and that is, of course, the upfront exemption on capital equipment. There are other credits in the bill, the angel credit, the business credits, the work that Senator Saltzman did, and now I'm very pleased to be able to offer the A2 amendment, which provides for a deduction, a subtraction from federal taxable income of 10% of the pass-through income to individual shareholders and partners from Minnesota partnerships, S-corps, and LLCs. And as the chairman has indicated, the money that is now on the bottom line is available to give some of these additional incentives to Minnesota businesses and taxpayers, and I'm very pleased to be able to offer this amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just to be clear, Senator Rest, for S-corps, for partnerships,
and LLCs.
And LLCs, this would allow them to pass 10% of their net income through without tax liability.
Exactly, to exclude 10% of their pass-through income from Minnesota taxation, which even given the tax increases on income that are in the bill would affect their marginal rates in a very positive way. And that's specifically focused on these people that participate in those business organizations in Minnesota. The capital equipment exemption, as you know, is focused mostly on manufacturers, big and small. This is another cut at a different way in which people participate in Minnesota's business economy.
So, and Senator Rest, I don't have the fiscal note on this. The cost of it is?
As the Department of Revenue estimated it in my bill, Senate File 1274, that 10% subtraction in FY 2010 was $69.9, $11.64.1, and $12.79.2. And I don't know whether it's adjusted for the calendar year, fiscal year, as we normally have to do, and whether there would be a new fiscal note. But the dollars are there for this purpose.
So what we're going to carry on this spreadsheet is pretty close, if you average it, about $70 million a year in
That's
tax
correct,
relief
Chairman.
For businesses.
Yes.
Committee understand the amendment? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, a couple of things about this. I heard you say that we were funding it with some other provision in the bill that we were going to repeal it, and it was the subtraction. I'm trying to recall what you just said. Is there a line item on the spreadsheet that I can identify?
Senator Ortman, we're copying the new spreadsheet now that is going to incorporate the changes of Senator Ress and a couple other small changes. The money came to us. We were carrying a line on the spreadsheet yesterday that repealed the exemption of the mortgage interest on second homes. And the department, as of late yesterday, still had not given us an estimate of how much money that would raise. And we got that number late yesterday or last evening, and now Senator Rest is proposing to spend some of that money. So by repealing the exemption on home mortgage on mortgage interest on second homes, we're able to do about $70 million a year in income tax relief for what are mostly small businesses. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I think there are some ways that we can improve the bill just the way that Senator Rest is proposing, and I think that's an improvement. One of the concerns I had, and I had a bill similar to your provision to do the pass-through income, is that there are certain transactions that are huge transactions, like a settlement and a major lawsuit might mean that a shareholder in a law firm might make a $10 million income in 1 year, or there might be a bonus or a stock option payment or something like that. And so in my provision, I had a $500,000 cap on the pass-through because I think we do want to capture that income if it's a very high income payment. And so you may want to add some kind of an upper base to that to make sure that we capture those big transactions. Just a suggestion.
Senator Ortman, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I don't have that as part of this, and I think that the revenue estimate was based on taking that into consideration. But as a policy matter, that that might be advisable. But I think some of those instances, and you probably know better than I, but some of those instances are not necessarily income to the they don't count as income to the recipient.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, some will and some won't. And
right.
That's why I thought that it made sense to put a cap at 500,000. It was 10% or 20% up to, mm-hmm. say, 500,000 or up to a million. But I do think that when we've got those very large transactions, we do want to capture that income. Certainly do that as opposed to the taxing property or rental payments or, repealing that. I mean, so I think we should be looking at those types of impacts if possible. That's my recommendation.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I have a question about the revenue thing. I'm understanding from Senator Rest the cost of this is how much?
It's about 70 a year.
Senator Marty, there is with the money that the second home mortgage interest deduction brought, there was some significant money on the spreadsheet, about $250 million that was going into the budget reserve. So the later amendment that I think you're referring to relative to the renter's credit actually ends up using some of the money that would have otherwise gone to the budget reserve. And that's the reason we can't do Senator Rest's proposal for 4 years. We can only do it for three because there is not enough money in 12 and 13 to do it for both years. But there is enough to do it for 3 years.
But, Mr. Chairman, then with the rent credit, which you only have 1 year in the bill already, so, but that's $50 million right there. With the property tax refund for homeowners as well, I'm missing something where the numbers are because I thought it was $70 million per year for the.
But Senator Marty, there was about. In the spreadsheet we had yesterday, there was about $259 million going into the budget reserve.
So you're taking some of
it from
budget
reserve. We're taking some of the budget reserve money in order to, Senator Ortman, we're going to have an amendment later that takes the renter's credit deduction out of the bill. And we're going to use some of the money that would have gone into the budget reserve in order to do that. And that is the benefit of having the bill out overnight is some members have talked about, is it really a good idea to put money into the budget reserve and at the same time cut their renter's credit? So that's the discussion we're going to have on a later amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, on this amendment, is the proposed $70 million a year of savings, is that based on a tax rate of the new fourth tier in most perhaps small business situations, 9.25%, or does that I suspect it is. I wouldn't believe it would go back to 7.8. It's not based on 7.85. It's based on 9.25. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, it's based on the revenue estimate in Senator Rest's bill, so it's based on current law today.
Well,
Senator Rest?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my bill, I had had a, I had gone to a fourth bracket at 8.5, so that these savings are at 8.5, but of course they get the benefit of the lower rates too. So I doubt if it's going to be more than this, but
so
we would have to get a more accurate.
It may score slightly less, and we'll have revenue.
But it's certainly in the ballpark for people to understand.
It's close, Senator Sutton, but might be slightly less. But anyway, it is some significant tax relief for businesses. And, you know, the chair recognizes what we're doing with the business property tax in this bill to help get the budget into balance. But this offsets an awful lot of that business property tax increase for really smaller businesses. On the rest motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails. We have the honors. I'll move it. Chair moves the A10 amendment. This is the author's amendment. And members, there's a lot of stuff in here. I need to have counsel come up and walk through this for you. It's a result of discussions of many of you as members of this committee and many of you who follow this committee to address some of the concerns that people had about some of the provisions that were not included in yesterday's draft. Ms. Off?
Mr. Chairman, members, the A10 amendment, the first provisions on page 1, going from page 1, line 3 through page 1, line 18, are just corrections of the income tax brackets and the years so that they match up with the plan that was set forth and that was included in the spreadsheet. So this essentially just corrects these references so that they accomplish what the author intended there. On line 119, that's just a correction of proper language for direction as to use of the film credit or one of the income tax credits.
Mr. Chair, can we go back? I'm very sorry, but I just want to make sure I really understand. What you just said is that it looks to me like you're changing the income levels for the application of the income tax brackets. And so are you saying that now these dollar amounts fit the spreadsheet? Is that what you just said?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, that's correct. And these changes in the dollar amounts for the brackets reflect the inflation that's in the current law. When we change the income tax rates at any time, we need to update those to what's in under the current law income tax indexing.
So, Mr. Chair, we did an inflationary increase before in the text of the bill, and we're doing another one now. Is that?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, this just corrects the way it should have been presented in the bill in the first place so that when the increase of the rate is effective, it applies to the brackets that are automatically being increased under current law.
So this is current law, Senator Ortman. It just expresses it in dollars in statute rather than through just an inflation-adjusted provision.
Thank you.
The amendments beginning on page 1, line 20 through line 25 reflect the deletion of the repeal of the sales tax exemption for the North Star Commuter Rail and the Central Corridor rail projects. On lines 26 through 30, these are changes in the provision that was dealing with the pollution control exemption for pollution control equipment at an electric generating facility. That had provided that the advice of the Pollution Control Agency with respect to eligibility for the credit should be presented to the county and the municipality in which the property is located. rather than just asking them to review and comment, this would have each of them approve the recommendations for the exemption and provides that if the exemption, if there's no response from the municipality within 90 days, it's deemed to be approved by them. On lines 31 and 32, there is an amendment to the study of property that's used for horse breeding and horse boarding so that will be done in consultation with the Commissioner of Agriculture. On line 33, the deletion of sections 2 and 3 is the elimination of the changes to the property tax refund and the rent credit provisions. So those will remain in effect as in current law. The bill does still repeal the targeting provision. Line 34 of page 1 is the elimination of the section that transferred responsibility for PILT payments from the DNR to revenue. Beginning on line 35 of page 1 and continuing through page 2, line 1, is a modification of the provision that would have prohibited future municipal incorporations and instead makes that a temporary prohibition on new incorporations, which would begin, the prohibition would end as of June 1st, 2014. The second line on page 2 refers to the proposal to provide an additional five-year period added on to the existing five-year rule for tax increment financing districts. This will now apply to districts that were certified after June 30th, 2003. Line 3 is just a technical correction to one of the TIF provisions that were discussed yesterday to insert the new language in an appropriate place for the timing of when loans were authorized. On line 4, there is the deletion of a provision that was included in the original draft that dealt with the prohibition of additional water being drawn from an aquifer or inclusion of an auditorium or theater in the Mall of America project. So that section is deleted from the bill under this amendment.
Mr. Chairman, line 2.4, is that what you're looking at?
Yes.
Ms. Zoff, it's page 133, or at least in the version I have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Russ, there's a kind of a confusing, I think this is a glitch in the new revisor system, in that if you look at the side numbering of the bill.
Numbers on the side of the page.
Wow. They don't match up. Yeah.
That's very confusing.
It's very confusing.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can read it now, though. I wasn't paying attention to that. Thank you.
The provision that is added beginning on page 2, line 5, is it was Senate File 311 dealing with the City of St. Louis Park. This is an addition of the duration of that tax increment district. Page 2, line 15 through line 19 is an addition of the City of Fridley to the provision that would enable them to use the Housing Improvement District law, even though they had not acted to the City Council had not acted on that when it was enacted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if there's a lot of cities out there that realize that we've capped their TIFs or their extension. I'm surprised we didn't hear from more cities overnight.
Well, Senator Johnson, there is a broader, there's a broader provision in the bill that extends the five-year rule under which development has to happen to 10 years, and we had a number of bills that did that, so we just thought we would do a broad exemption for all cities, So all cities are going to get a waiver from the five-year rule on redevelopment districts?
And renewal and renovation.
Redevelopment, renewal, and renovation districts, not just the cities that came in with a bill.
The amendment on page 2, lines 20 and 21, is just a correction of a reference to the provision dealing with the tax increment financing district in the city of Sauk Rapids. They are able to accomplish their purpose by 2012, and that was stated in the committee, so we don't need the additional reference to 3 years after the date of the demolition. On line 22, there's a correction of a reference to the occupation tax. Beginning on page 2, line 23, there is an amendment to the taconite production tax distribution provision, and the operative language there is at the top of page 4 of the amendment. This provides that if there are insufficient tax proceeds from the production tax to make the distributions, and this refers to a particular distribution to a number of school districts from the formula, if the tax proceeds are insufficient to make the required distribution, then the money that would have been needed to make that distribution whole will be taken from the taconite property tax relief account to the extent of the shortfall. At the bottom of page 4 of the amendment, there's a new provision that authorizes a grant to a manufacturer of windmill blades located within the taconite tax relief area. This is contingent on a majority vote of the members of the Iron Ranges Resources and Rehabilitation Board to make available $10 million from the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Trust Fund for that project. That could be as a grant or a forgivable loan to the manufacturer. If the IRRB votes to make that distribution, then an additional $10 million would be provided from the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection if that amount is taken from the DJJ fund, then an additional $10 million is appropriated from the general fund for the same purpose, and an additional $10 million is taken from the Minnesota Minerals 21st Century Fund.
Members, I want to make sure everybody understands what that is. I have been had a couple meetings with a Minnesota company that wants to build a wind blade manufacturing plant in Minnesota. And ultimately, it will employ about 850 people. It's a very, very big economic development project. It will require about a 300,000 square foot building. And we have been looking for vacant buildings to try and put that in. They actually have toured a couple of them. It may end up requiring a new building. So this would commit $10 million from the DJJ. There is about $10 million in the 21st Century Minerals Fund, which normally would be used on the range in some kind of a value-added iron project or a non-ferrous mining project. This would create an additional use for the 21st Century Fund money that also under current law has to be spent in the taconite relief area. And then it does have a $10 million appropriation from the general fund for the project. So it speaks to my point, members, that I've been mentioning recently, that the state has not been making as significant of an investment in economic development as we should. And we have an opportunity with a Minnesota company with a new technology to build what I believe is going to be the premier wind blade made in the world with a totally new technology. And the discussions that I have had with the principal is that it would be a forgivable loan, not a grant, so that if certain employment levels were met over a period of time, which is similar to what was done with Northwest Airlines on the range when they built a reservation center, that over a period of a number of years, if employment levels are met, the loan would be forgiven. But we are in Minnesota is in competition with North Dakota, Iowa, and Texas for this plant. So this is this financing package is along the lines of the discussions that I've had with the principal in order to secure this plant in Minnesota. And it is, if the technology works like they expect, it is the first of what is probably five plants that are going to be built to make windmill blades.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I normally support anything that the Iron Range does is trying to diversify its job base. But the appropriating of a total of $30 million to start up a business, nobody's lobbied me on this, and I don't know who this company is. I don't know if they've even built a windmill before. Heck, I would even gladly retire and start up a windmill plant if you're going to give me $30 million to do that. But I guess I'm a little concerned about the $10 million from the general fund. And usually, and you know that I try to diversify the economy in rural Minnesota, especially in northern Minnesota, up in your neighborhood, as much as I can. But this may tiptoe over the line a little bit, especially since I haven't had anyone lobby me on it. This is the first time I've ever heard about this appropriation.
Senator Limmer, many businesses do not wish to have their negotiations played out in the front page of newspapers. And boards of directors and CEOs are very sensitive about that. That's why it's very difficult, I think, for state agencies to do economic development because of the public meeting requirements. Boards of directors are very sensitive to that. But, Senator Limmer, if we really want to get into the green manufacturing business, if we think that's important, and this committee has heard bills about green jobs and green manufacturing, we are not going to do that without money. I'm told by this principal that the governor of Texas has $1 billion in the checkbook to attract windmill manufacturing. This is a long ways away from that. They certainly are going to put a better package together than Minnesota could ever put together. But this individual is from Minnesota, has grown his business in Minnesota, and I just will tell you, he is the real deal. And if he makes a decision to do this in Minnesota, it'll be a big deal for this state.
Well, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Limmer, it can't be done without money.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I know that it's quite alluring under the labeling of green jobs, that there's a lot of public money going in to make a lot of people rich these days. I was just at a conference where we were talking about windmills, and the bang for the buck that you get out of a windmill as opposed to other sources is negligible of what we're trying to do to satisfy our energy needs. In California, you have major power lines coming out of the Hoover Dam area and going into Southern California. Gigantic power lines that go through. But it goes through a mountain slope area full of windmills. For about as far as you can see on the mountain slopes, you got windmills, kind of destroying the vista that you have there. And a tiny little electric line comes out of the windmills in order to produce the energy that's needed for Southern California. And I'm not so sure if windmills are really the cure-all to everything that we've been told about. And quite honestly, when you look at the scale of public dollar investment, I'm not even sure if it's worth it. If we didn't prop it up like other green things, the industry couldn't run on its own. And I just hope that if this would go through, that we aren't contributing to a production system that has to be continually propped up by government subsidies in order to produce anything.
Senator Limmer, I share your skepticism about windmills and the cost of that power. I mean, it's not free because the wind happens to blow for free. I'm well aware of that. Well, one thing I learned in dealing with this principle is the company in Pipestone that's making wind blades. From India. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal last week that they are no longer making windmill blades for new towers any longer because they have recalled 1,200 blades that are on existing towers because the fiberglass is cracking. This is a new technology that I believe, from what I can see, if it works, it will be the next thing in windmill construction. And I know just from personal experience, Minnesota Power built 10 windmills up on the Iron Range in Senator Tomasoni's district last year. All 10 have been taken down because the fiberglass cracked in the blades before they ever really made any power. So there is a big problem in windmill blade design. The industry is developing faster, and more construction is happening before the technology to make a blade has been properly engineered. And there is a new technology needed, and this company believes that they have the newest technology. They are building prototype blades right now, portions of prototype blades in Pennsylvania to test the strength, because it is something totally different in the way blades are constructed from what we currently see today. And I've met with the Commissioner of Finance about this project, and Senator Limmer, we're going to find out in conference committee more about this and see if the governor is willing to support some general fund money for it. But I certainly hope in the conference committee that if this project continues to look viable, that we don't let it get away to Texas or North Dakota. And I know for a fact the governor of North Dakota has called this principal and asked them what can North Dakota do to get this plant. I know that conversation happened. So, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, this kind of reminds me of a Job Z discussion. And quite often we pit one corporation that gets the benefits of Job Z against a corporation that doesn't have it. So they have a marketplace advantage. By putting up, if this would go into effect, are we subsidizing a corporation that may be the death knell of the corporation located in Pipestone that's providing jobs there?
Senator Limmer, I don't know what the future of the company in Pipestone is, except that they are an international company. They are headquartered in India. This company is headquartered in Minnesota. I've been to their office in Minneapolis, and if this legislature makes a decision that we want to subsidize a Minnesota corporation, and somehow that puts a corporation in India at some competitive disadvantage, well, I guess I'm willing to take the criticism for that. But it is not the same kind of product. It is not remotely the same kind of product than is made in Pipestone. It is a total redesign of windmill blades.
Can you tell me who the corporation is?
No, not today. Conference committee, we're going to learn that, I'm sure, Senator Limmer. Senator Orban?
Mr. Chair, I've been a student of the state Senate for 7 years now, and I guess I've learned that if you're chairman of the finance committee, you can have $40 million to forgive a loan in your city, and if you're a chair of the tax committee, you can have $10 million out of the general fund for a project in your community, even if we're having a budget crisis. I couldn't find $10 million to pay for expungements for regular Minnesotans who want a second chance to go find a job. I couldn't find $125,000 to pay for the Forensic Laboratory Board. It's amazing to me that these bills come up with these great big fat pots of money for those who have the power around here, and regular Minnesotans, just like regular junior senators, can't find money anywhere for really important proposals. And I just had to say that because I find it very frustrating that at the last minute we can add something like this to this bill without ever having had a hearing. We haven't heard anything from the Department of Economic Development. We haven't confirmed anything about this project, but we'll put it in this bill. Nobody asked me what I wanted in this bill. I haven't offered. I haven't said what I needed. I haven't said anything. But I have to say, as a 7-year member, I take exception to the fact that we're going to add this kind of money into this bill at this last minute under these economic circumstances.
Council?
Mr. Chairman, the... Okay. On page 5 of the amendment, there are two sections that are added beginning on line 18, and those provide for blank previous or currently not stated changes in the rate of the provider tax on hospitals and surgical centers. And then the remainder of the amendment beginning on page 5, line 31, and going through all the way through the end of the amendment are provisions that were amended onto a bill that was heard in committee but did not get picked up when that bill was added to the draft of the omnibus bill. So those were amendments that were added to Senator Bach's bill on the audit of charitable gambling organizations, and they were intended to be in the bill. I was reminded that when the change in making the moratorium on incorporations was added, we should also delete the repeal of the section that explains how incorporations are accomplished. So on page 142, we should delete line 5.
I'll incorporate that. On the A-10 amendment, Senator Irvin.
Mr. Chair, can we go back to page 5, lines 19 through 30. It looks like we have a hospital tax and a surgical center tax. And I'm sorry, but it doesn't say what the percent of gross revenues are that we're taxing.
Senator Ortman, back in 2005, in the negotiations with the governor on the budget, there was an agreement by governor and leadership to increase the cigarette tax by 75 cents. And that provision was carried in the Health and Human Service bill. I wasn't the tax chair at the time, but I did feel that if the cigarette tax was going to be increased, it ought to be carried in the tax bill. And so what this is simply a marker on the Minnesota care tax. Doesn't propose any increase. It just is in here that in the event, in the negotiations with the governor, as the session concludes, that if the Minnesota care tax is something that's going to be negotiated in the Health and Human Service bill, I want that potential tax increase to be carried in the tax bill, not in the Health and Human Service bill. So if a 1% increase in some kind of a health impact fee that really is an increase in the provider tax ends up getting signed into law, I want a marker in the tax bill so that it can be carried in the tax bill, not in the Health and Human Service bill, because it clearly is a tax under current law. So it doesn't raise anything. It just, I think, gives us some flexibility in negotiations with the governor as we try to see if we can conclude balancing the budget.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the language on line 1.33 on the property tax refund, the circuit breaker rent credit, and homestead refund. I think that's critically important. That was one sore point in the bill, and I really appreciate your pulling that out. I think it'll make a big difference for a lot of people who are being hurt a lot these days.
Thank you, Senator Marty. And just to be clear for those of you that are watching, what the portion of the amendment that Senator Marty speaks to removes from the bill the cut in the renter's credit, and it removes from the bill the cut in the property tax refund program that were on the earlier spreadsheet. And those are made possible largely by by taking some money out of what was going to go into the budget reserve and some money made available by eliminating the exemption from income on mortgage interest on second homes. On the A-10 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion prevails. The A-10 is adopted. Other amendments? Is Commissioner Nelson here? Chair has one that Senator Tomasoni requested, but he's got one of his. Senator Pogemiller.
I think I have one. The A16, I think.
I can hold off if you haven't reviewed it yet.
No, Senator Pogelman, we can take that up. I know you and I had this discussion, good. Senator Pogelman, are you?
Sure, I would offer the A-16. Mr. Chairman, members, I think the way the draft is constructed is that there was an automatic repeal of the income taxes by a time certain. And it seems to me that what we ought to do is structure this for structural balance. And if the economy comes back quickly, this amendment would allow a backing off of those increases, because the purpose of the increase in income tax is to get structural balance. It's not to do new spending. And so this amendment may not be perfectly drafted yet, but the intent is that the reason for the revenue increase is to structurally balance the budget. That's what we're trying to do. We're basically cutting budgets about 50% of the way and raising revenue the other 50% of the way. Then you got the one-time money factored separately from that. But the big picture is roughly a 7% permanent reduction in spending is about as far as some people think we can go. And then the rest is made up by the income tax. If the economy comes back, which it will, we just don't know when, this amendment would allow either a drawing, my preference would be a drawing down of that rather than just a blink off to keep us in structural balance. But that's what the intent of this language is to try to do. Again, I'm not sure it's perfectly drafted, but the idea is that the income tax increase is tied to structural balance. It's not for new spending.
So, Senator Pogelman, the effect of this is currently in the bill, we have the income tax increase blinking off after 4 years. What the amendment would do is say that it would blink off at such time a February forecast would show enough of a surplus on June 30th that the additional income tax in this bill would no longer be needed.
Correct. Yes, Mr. Chairman. And it may need to be worked on a little bit. There may have to be some phasing of that. It may not all happen in one event. But it just seems like the intent of the chair, as I have understood your discussion, is that we're just trying to fill a hole here, a deficit. We're not trying to create new spending. And I think that this approach, I think, is better fitted to the way the Senate budget's put together.
Thank you.
Discussion on the Pogelman Amendment. Senator Whitman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogelman. I appreciate the fact that we're trying to have this tax sunset or blink off. I'd like to ask if I could, and I mean this in a sincere fashion, why should we be focusing on the structural deficit right now and trying to correct that now when Minnesotans, in my estimation, can't afford that, and I you must believe that they can. And so why should they put that above all other interests right now?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogelman.
Senator Ertman, excellent question. We know when we left here last session that we had a $1 billion structural problem, and that's before the economy fell apart. We know under some proposals that there's a built-in increase in that structural deficit, almost tripling it. We're never going to get ahead of this situation if we don't take our medicine and make the kind of base adjustments in spending and revenue enhancements that are necessary to get ourselves fiscally stable again. Because when the economy does come back, it would seem to me we want to try to be able to invest in things that people then see, oh, okay, now we're spending additional money and it's actually doing something. Whereas, as you and I both know, in the schools, it's been about 10 years since we've really put additional money in. We've put money in to try to get rid of the cross-subsidy and special ed. We put money in to try to buy back budget shifts. And it just seems that this is the moment in time where the severity of the problem is so great that our citizens, I think, understand that just getting ourselves back into a fiscally stable situation is of utmost importance so that we can fulfill our commitments on spending that we tell people we're making Whereas the real story is we're not keeping up with inflation. School districts have this problem. You know, legislators say we put 3% into the budget and everything should be good at the school level. Whereas the reality is that 3% wasn't enough because it was either buying off the cross-subsidy and the special ed formula that wasn't fully funded or is not paying for inflation. And so school districts, as an example, rightly see that they've made no progress in the last decade. Every school district's made no progress in terms of this financial situation. And it just seems like we should get ourselves into a fiscally stable situation where when you tell somebody you're investing, you really are. And it just seems this is the moment to do it. I think Minnesotans understand how severe this budget crisis is, and we're calling for shared sacrifice, both on the spending side and on the revenue side. And as you know, the Senate budget has the deepest level of spending reductions of any of the proposals before the legislature this year. And that's part and parcel with this notion of getting stability.
Senator Orban.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogamiller, I'm really glad that we're having this conversation. I agree with you about stability being an important goal. And I agree that our budgets have had structural deficits and that we have not been keeping up with inflation. Totally agree with that. I do think we should fix it, and I do think that it is a very good long-term goal. I just don't know why we're making it the immediate short-term goal with all of the pain that goes along with that. And if I could finish, I think that what we're doing by raising all these taxes is making it harder on families to recover, harder on businesses to recover, and harder to provide the very revenues that we need to stabilize the state on a long-term basis. Because, as you know, even in February and March, our revenues went down even further. We ended up with an increased deficit of $46 million in the state just since our last forecast. And so what I'm concerned about is, as we keep drawing into the pockets of Minnesotans and drawing into their reserves, they don't have the money to invest. They don't have money to pay for college. College applications and registrations are down. They don't have the money that they need to invest in their families, their businesses, and into the state's future. And their stability, in my view, should come first and our second. So maybe it's just a very big philosophical difference, but I think it's an important one for Minnesotans. And maybe I can't claim that they all agree with me, but I believe that most of them do. And I think they could understand that even though it's the responsible thing to do to address our structural deficit, they would understand and appreciate the fact that we didn't try to do it at a time when they are in crisis, that maybe we could do it, deal with their crisis first, and then over the long term correct the structural deficit.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamiller.
Senator Ortman, it's more than a philosophical argument. First, it's our job, and it's the law, to try to balance the budget. Secondly, we all know that this is a time of shared sacrifice by all, because there is no way out of this. There is no way to say we're not going to tighten your belt in police departments, schools, county services, the courts. And what we're trying to do with the revenue is to say you can't do it all by tightening your belt. You cannot destroy the basic fabric of our public services but with a 14% cut to get our job number one, which is to balance the budget, in order. And so what the Senate's on the path of doing is roughly a 50-50 approach to that. And if the economy turns around, we know the Commissioner of Finance sat in front of the committee a month and a half ago, and said we have a revenue problem because the bottom fell out of our revenues. And what Senator Bach has constructed, or the committee is constructing, is a proposal to ask those that still do. If you're unemployed, you're not going to be affected by this because you're not going to have the income to pay these taxes. But if you still do have a job, and if you're still successfully able to function in terms of purchases of goods and services, then this is a sacrifice that we're asking. We're asking if you could pay a little more now, if you still have a job, to protect our schools, to protect our courts, to protect our judiciary, to protect our public services, and to help those who are unemployed. That's exactly what this does, and I think the fact that we were unable in good budget times to get structural balance
indicates that it's unlikely that there's the level of commitment by some to get our fiscal house in order. When Governor Carlson left here, when he finished his term of 8 years, our fiscal house was in order. It's not the case today. And I think it's in our interest as a state and as a community to get back to the standard that Governor Carlson set, which is only spend on things you can afford, don't overpromise, and balance the books. And I'm afraid that leaving a $2.6 billion deficit is not balancing the books.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, as I said, I don't disagree with your goals. I just don't think that I don't agree that this is the time to make it right, as you would say, because Minnesotans are already earning less because of the economy, and that's the last 2 months. The reason that our revenues have fallen over the last 2 months has been because of the income tax. People are already earning less. They have less and less disposable income.
Not all people.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Pogemiller, what I'm reporting to you is what our Department of Revenue has said, was that $46 million that we ended up with in an additional shortfall is because income taxes are dropping. The revenues that we raise from income is falling because Minnesotans have less and less income. And so what we're saying is, even though you have less income, we're going to take even more of that income away from you to resolve the state's structural budget deficit. And that's the part that I don't agree with, because I don't believe that Minnesotans have unlimited income and unlimited resources to continue to give more to government when they're finding a difficult time taking care of their family obligations, taking care of their businesses, investing, and responding. I understand about shared sacrifice, Mr. Chair and Senator Pogemiller, but I don't think that sacrifice should be the focus here. It should be the economic health of everybody, not just the state, also the cities, the families, the businesses, and the individuals. And I think that we are sacrificing their financial health for a balanced structural balance in our budget. And, Mr. Chair, there are other options we could look at, and I wish we would.
Mr. Chairman, just very briefly, sir, I see we have a difference of opinion. I know that you in your press conference yesterday, and Senator Senjum in a previous one, said that you don't support balancing the budget. I just think it's our job, and I think we should do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could correct you, Senator Pogemiller, I absolutely agree. We must balance our budget. We don't have a choice about that. But we do have a choice about whether we correct the structural deficit right now. There are one-time shifts. I know you don't like them. They are available to us. We have chosen in the Senate not to do that. The House has chosen to go ahead and use some of that one-time shift money. I think Minnesotans would prefer that we did that now. The reason why is because they're doing one-time shifts in their family budgets at their kitchen table right now. They're pulling money out of every last resource they have, and they're making decisions about college. They're making decisions about their future. They're making decisions to put off maintenance on their house. They're making all of those decisions in order to survive. We should not be adding more pain to the struggles that they face in order to have what I think is a great goal that we could accomplish, but not now.
Senator Ortman, I believe what the chair heard yesterday, to Senator Pogemiller's point, was that you didn't think it was important to balance the budget in the next biennium. You understood we have a constitutional requirement to do it in this biennium, but I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you said you thought in the next biennium it wasn't necessary for us to balance the budget. I think that's what Senator Pogemiller is indicating. I believe that's what I heard yesterday, but you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't believe that I spoke about the next biennial budget. I know we will have a responsibility then as well to balance our budget. What you're saying is, do we need to balance our budget in the out years now? And I know that's what your goal is. But I see a whole lot of families and businesses in the state of Minnesota that have no idea how they're going to balance their budget in 4 years and 5 years. And they're living month to month already. I'm very concerned about that, and I hope that you will take that to heart when we continue with this budget and with this tax bill. My preference would be that we reversed our process here instead of coming up with our budgets and our plans for spending and then going back and meeting our tax targets that we did the opposite, that we came up with a good tax policy that made a lot of sense in the state of Minnesota and then met the spending targets.
You know, Senator Ortman, I kind of made these comments yesterday, but it doesn't seem right to me for this legislature and this governor to not balance the budget in the next biennium. I mean, it's not fair for in 2010 for us to elect a new governor, elect a new legislature, and their first task, a governor gets elected in November of 10, his first task is to assemble a budget for the next biennium. And he's going to start working on that before he's even sworn in. And that the first thing that new governor has to do is address a problem that we left him. And under the governor's proposal, a $2.5 billion deficit. That's what you're elected to solve. And it seems irresponsible to me for us to hit the gavel and go home knowing that we left a $2.5 billion deficit for the next group of people are going to sit around this table and for the next governor to address it. It doesn't seem responsible for us to know we're leaving that to the next group of elected officials that are responsible for managing the state.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you, but except on one important thing, it could be a she that's the next governor. But aside from that correction, Mr. Chair, let me just say that we did that in the last biennium. We left a structural deficit. I know Senator Pogemiller disagreed with that. I disagreed with that. We spent that money. We drew down our desserts. We did get our desserts. We drew down the reserve. I voted against that budget. I would vote against it again. I didn't create this. I know Minnesotans didn't create this. I know it's the reality that we all have to deal with. But as you say, Minnesotans don't understand the enormity. Do we understand the enormity of what their situation is? If this is truly a crisis, an economic crisis, and I believe it is an economic crisis, not just a budget deficit crisis, we should consider all of the impacts of the crisis, and I think that we would do better, even though it may be less than the most responsible thing to do, to survive the storm with less sacrifice and less pain for Minnesotans, and then come back and start again and hope that the economy recovers. Because I think, Senator Pogemiller, with all due respect, when you increase income taxes to this extent, we exacerbate the problem instead of making it better. And I'm very concerned about that. So you may be well-intentioned that you hope that the government or that the economy recovers and we can blink off these income taxes, but I think we're contributing to the very problem that Minnesotans face, and we won't be able to see the recovery that we need.
On the Pogemiller motion to adopt the A-16 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The contrary, no. The motion prevails. A-16 is adopted. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the A-5 amendment. And, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy moves the A-5 amendment on behalf of Senator
Stump. Mr. Chair and members, when this is being passed out,
Senator Scoy, on the A-5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. There's four school districts in the state that Senator Stump is concerned about, and they do a sharing of their career and technical program. And currently, they're not able to levy those dollars across the school districts that are participating in the shared program. We certainly want to encourage the sharing of these programs, and this amendment would allow them to levy the authority among the participating school districts in this shared program. And Mr. Nauman is here to answer questions.
Do members have any questions that Mr. Nauman can answer? Would anybody like to testify on the amendment? On the Scoy motion to adopt the A-5. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. The chair would like to move the A-17 amendment on behalf of Senator Tomasoni. Commissioner Nelson, why don't you come tell us what this issue is all about? Members, Commissioner Nelson is a county commissioner for St. Louis County. He's a constituent of Senator Tomasoni's, and he is a get-it-done commissioner in St. Louis County, I can tell you. So, Commissioner, explain to us what we're doing with this language.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. With this language, we allow for the retention of current fees to support an important resource within our communities, the law libraries that exist within our courts, and also some of the funding for specialty courts that would, again, further serve the community. This is a retention of current statutory responsibility that the counties have.
And Commissioner, how many dollars for a parking violation are we talking about here?
Approximately an impact to property taxpayers of about $160,000 if this is not retained.
So an increase in the county's levy by about $160,000
without this permissive language, Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Senator Rest.
Question, just a question for council. What is 4490 sub 6? Or Senator Skoy, do you know what it is? She's finding out.
Senator, council's
chair. She's finding out.
Council's chair. Senator Pogelner.
Chairman, it seems like this should have been dealt with in the bill we had on the floor yesterday.
Yep.
I don't think this has much to do with the tax bill.
Senator Tomasoni, Senator Pogelner, I think Senator Tomasoni is trying to get a Senate position on this, and I think this probably didn't come to his attention until after his bill was gone. I think if he can get a Senate position on this, you'll likely see this come back in his conference committee report.
But his is the wrong bill, too. This is a judiciary bill.
Yeah, sure.
And I think we debated this on the floor quite at length yesterday. Am I judiciary committee members? Didn't we kind of vet this thing at a... Well, whatever. This really has not much to do with the tax bill.
Chair's amendment.
Senator Pogelner, I suspect this will be a bit hard to hold in the conference committee if it's on the bill. And that's a discussion we'll have to have with Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, Section 484.90, Subdivision 6, is the current law on the allocation of fees that are payable to the court administrator, and it provides that the county administrator provides the name of the municipality or other subdivision of government where the offense was committed and that employed the apprehending officer. And then the county treasurer pays to the municipality all fines or penalties for parking violations for which complaints and warrants have not been issued, and one-third of all fines or penalties collected during the previous months for offenses committed within the municipality from persons arrested or issued citations. And
I don't understand the explanation. What's happening now that would change with this amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I'm not very familiar with this at all, as you can tell, but it appears that it provides for the allocation of most of these fees to the municipality that employs the arresting officer. So rather than being retained by the county.
I think the issue, Madam Council and Senator Rest, is in the case of St. Louis County, they maintain three different law libraries. And they made a decision years ago to commit part of the parking fees or the parking citations to make modernizations to the law library. The law library in Duluth the renovations were completed, and the other two law libraries, and I'm not sure, Commissioner, maybe you can tell us which were one of the other two done that are in Senator Tomasoni's district. But anyway, the the money didn't remain committed to finish the other law libraries in the state. It only did the Duluth one. Commissioner, am I close?
Mr. Chair, if I may, yes. The dollars, the statute that provides, the Minnesota state statute that provides the county the authority to fund law libraries, and please, if I confused you with my statement of specialty courts, what I am talking about is the county's support staff to those courts, which we are required to provide. This funding is funding that was allocated to provide, one, the law library funding mechanism, which under Minnesota state statute we are required to have in all courthouses where they pre-existed, and I can't recall the exact date, but essentially if you had a law library, we are required to continue that as a maintenance of effort. And along with that legislation, you provided the county board with a funding mechanism. This essentially retains that funding mechanism in the event that the fee structure is changed within cities and they no longer determine that it's necessary to pay the counties. This funding mechanism then goes away, and it would require us to levy to support those under Minnesota state statute. We would be required to levy those additional dollars. And that is why we are here, St. Louis County being unique in the respect that we have three courthouses, existing courthouses, and all three of those we are required to maintain a law library in them.
Senator Moore.
You know, Mr. Chair, this is why this conversation needs to take place, not just in the Judiciary Policy Committee, but really in Senator Foley's committee. There was a decision made to take out Senator Foley's prohibition of local ordinances, local governments from imposing ordinances. And because Senator Foley didn't prevail, that provision was taken out of his bill. And now we have St. Louis County here saying that they're going to be affected by it. And so I think that we do need to revisit the issue, because that's what happens when we allow local governments to take away the fiscal stream that we've fixed here at the legislature to balance out all the other pieces that are at play. And I think I understand what you're saying, Commissioner, and I think that that was I don't think your members understood that, or else they would not have voted to take out the prohibition. And so I just don't think that we're not going to be able to fix this here. The discussion really ought to be in judiciary. And I would have you go talk to your senator and have him do a bill. And I'm sure that before the legislative session ends, there'll be an opportunity to have a conversation. And I think that Senator Foley very much will look forward to helping Senator Tomasoni take care of your issue in his bill. It will go to conference, and he'll want to help you out.
So, Senator Ma, would you like us to withdraw the amendment? You're the chair of judiciary.
Yes.
Okay. Chair withdraws the A-17 amendment. Commissioner, thank you for coming down. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I have the A-7 amendment.
Have Tomasoni talk to Foley.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A-7 amendment, if members want to turn to page 108, it strikes lines 20 and 21. I'll read those. This was a provision that came in during the Green Acres Conference Committee, on which I served and a couple other members here served. And it was a provision that came in from the other chamber. They didn't bring it in their bill. It came in as an amendment, as a part of a package of amendments. And the effect of this language was really curious, and the rationale never quite made a whole lot of sense. And I think The effect of the language is that it kind of gets us back to square one with the problems that we've been struggling with on Green Acres. The language reads, no more than 50% of the total acreage of any agricultural homestead may be Class B property enrolled in this program. So if you recall, members, I draw a diagram because it's kind of hard to explain and understand just by the reading of the language. If you recall, you know, one of the big issues in Green Acres was you know, those parts that were deemed agricultural and or non-agricultural or productive or non-productive. We try not to use those words anymore. But and so as a consequence, those parts of a farm that weren't being actually tilled fell out of the Green Acres program. So people thought, what the heck, then we'll till it. And so we're losing lots of conservation benefit that was happening on people's farms. And so the remedy to that was, you know, the great idea that Senator Scoy had that people accepted as a pretty good remedy. But then this language came in and kind of unwinds all that. So what happens is, if no more than 50% of the total acreage can be, you know, in the what we'll call the Scoy fix. So what happens is if this much of the property is ag, the remainder is non-ag, it's conservation, then only an equal amount can come in under the conservation provisions. And so then who decides which 50%? And what happens to the other 50%? And it really does kind of unwind the whole remedy that people seem to agree was a good idea.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dibble, I oppose your amendment. I don't know when all of a sudden we decide to undo conference committee reports. This went through the process. It went through the conference committee. This was their remedy. So now in the tax bill, we're going to reestablish all of the work they supposedly undid. I'm the one that has a problem with the conservation district language, and I oppose the amendment. I don't want to go back to the way it was written. I'd like to honor the conference committee report.
Okay. I didn't get that in the amendment, but maybe we should just add this.
Senator Johnson, it was an interesting discussion we had in the conference committee on this subject, because this was a Representative Junkie provision in the House side. And when we actually had a vote on it, Senator Dibble and Senator Vandeveer, for totally different reasons, I mean, on opposite ends of the spectrum, voted against this provision. So, Senator Johnson, I think if we don't take it out in committee, I'm pretty certain that Senator Vandeveer is going to offer to take it out on the floor for a different reason that Senator Dibble has. But it wasn't a Senate provision, and to the point of the conference committee's work, Senator Johnson, the work the conference committee did is law, and we change laws all the time. That's what we do. So I do think it's in order. It's changing current law. But I'd like to hear from Senator Scoy on the provision, because he's put a lot of work, and I didn't know, Senator Dibble, that we were going to call the new Green Acres legislation the Scoy fix. but maybe it can catch on.
Mr. Chair, I would hope not. But Senator Dibble is right. This is going to be a huge issue for assessors to try to figure out how to deal with these three different classifications of land in the same area. And I think that this is something we should be taking and addressing in this tax bill. As I don't know how many of you could see the little diagram he had there, but you know, if somebody has 51% of their land in the ag homestead and it doesn't qualify for the program, they'll have 50 acres that's in the conservation reserve. They could have 20 acres in something else and 1 acre that's other. And who's going to decide what acre that one is? And I think take this out and move forward with this, and hopefully we'll be done with this Green Acres.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way I understand the conference committee report is we went back to prior to 08, the screw-up in 08. We went back to what we had previous, giving us time to work through some of these issues. According to the feedback I got from the conference committee, there wasn't enough money in the conservation district's budgets to kind of oversee this conservation district provision. Then supposedly revenue was going to look after it. I don't think it's been worked out, and the conference committee report goes back to pre-screw-up.
Mm-hmm. So, no, Senator Johnson, there was a lot of work done on a new rural preserve program by the conference committee. It does not go back to previous law relative to Green Acres. It is a significant change from the previous Green Acres law. Senator Scoy, do you want to speak to it? Is the department interested in testifying on this provision? Maybe Senator Scoy, we should hear what the commissioner thinks about...
Hey, Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue, and we would support the Dibble Amendment. We were scratching our heads a little bit ourselves, John Hagan and myself, when that language went in, how that would be administered, the headaches it would cause assessors, and after a little more looking at it and analyzing it, we think it's a good idea to pull that out. And it doesn't undermine, you know, the core of what we did in the conference committee. We really go back to the pre-2008. We have the grandfather, and I think that the deal is still the deal, and it's been struck, and I think it's a good compromise. But this was one that we kind of scratched our heads on after the fact, and I think Senator Dibble has a good amendment.
On the Dibble amendment to adopt the A7 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion prevails. A7 is adopted. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I have the A8 amendment. And I want to incorporate a change into it as soon as it's distributed, but I'll speak to this if I can while it is. There's a provision in the bill on page 98. It came from Senator Latz. It's not an unreasonable thing. I think it's a good provision, actually. But it's a thing where housing improvement districts that where, in effect, the city can help arrange financing and so on, like for a condo project to enable them to redo the roofing, like a special assessment, only they're doing it on a condo and so on. And it's Senator Latz's amendment, which is in the bill, extends the sunset on that for 4 more years. The issue that this amendment does, and I'm going to ask to incorporate in their deletion of lines 110 through 116. What this does is to say if you're going to do those housing improvement districts, you have to do it fairly. And the issue came up from one of the cities in my district. The condo owners, majority of the condo owners had much larger units than smaller ones, and they asked the city to assess them all equally, not based on square footage or, as you can see on lines 1.24 and so on, 1.25, the fee can be imposed on the basis of tax capacity, the housing unit, or square footage, or a method determined by the council. We want to say that if you're going to do something other than one of those standard assessments, that you got to give a reason for it and show that it's a fair way to do it. And this amendment would simply be, if we're going to extend those housing improvement districts, which I support doing, let's just make sure they do it fairly. I've talked with the cities about it. I only got the amendment this morning. I've shared it with them, and I've committed to them that if there's some trouble with the language beyond what that one deletion is, I'm happy to work with them before you get to the floor or the conference, whichever.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Fogelmeyer.
Senator Marty, I think you probably shouldn't put in line 129 to 130 in that it does not cause disproportionate burdens or financial hardship. How are they supposed to determine that? I just think the issue is fairness and equity. It's not.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bogemiller, yes, that's the point, is to get it fair and equitable. In a case like this, it was disproportionate hardship because some of the people who own the smallest units were paying thousands of dollars more than their fair share, and they were some of the folks who were lower income ones. So, your point is well taken. And if
we'll just put a period after basis,
And delete the rest of the sentence on line 129 and 130. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to incorporate that as well as deletion of lines 1.10 to 1.16.
Does everybody understand the A8 as orally incorporating deletion of lines 1.10 through 1.16, and on 1.29 after the word basis put a period, strike the balance of line 1.29, and strike everything on line 1.30 before the word fees.
That's
is
right.
That correct?
That's
somebody?
Correct.
Would anybody like to testify on this amendment?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. We visited with Senator Marty on this, and that we still do have some concerns. He has acknowledged some of the concerns in the deletions that he offered verbally. In particular, the issues on lines 130, 131, and 132, 133, where we have to make a finding that or we have to meet the special assessment benefit thresholds, is it could be very troubling for one of these projects. Please keep in mind, members, that the cities undertake these housing improvement projects to do common area improvements for condominium and other townhome type developments where property owners don't have any way to finance common area improvements. And they need to have some way to make sure every property owner participates to pay their share of the cost of the improvements. For example, putting a new roof on a building, you need to make sure that everybody's going to pay their fair share to make that happen. We really do these at the request, under the law, the request of the property owners to make sure that there is an enforcement mechanism to finance those improvements. And I'm just concerned that 429 language could be problematic for cities to reach, and we will work with Senator Marty to try to address that if this moves forward.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, he may be right. It may be important to take that out. If so, I'll commit to doing so. I just would like to keep it in now and talk further about it first.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. So a little work, members, is probably needed by the conference committee on this, but on the Marty motion to adopt the A8 amendment as orally amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. The motion prevails. A8 is adopted. Other amendments? Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I have the A18 amendment as well. Mr. Chairman, while this is being distributed, on page 134, there's a provision there about the next phase is of the Mall of America. And this is a provision, the language here is basically what we had in the tax bill last year as part of the project, only the language was put in such a place that it was tied to City of Bloomington putting a TIF on the proposal. And Bloomington decided not to, but the project may be going ahead anyway. And this was a labor peace agreement. And I think because of the fact we're not sure what phase two is anymore, on line 1.12, I would incorporate a change from phase two to any phase. So if they were to build a hotel as part of the next phase or the phase after that, it would be for the first 5 years of the hotel's operation, they'd have to have worked out a labor peace agreement so there's no boycotts or other things of the hotel.
Now, would anybody like to testify on the A18 amendment? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair. I support this amendment. I also just want to mention there were a couple of other, and you took some stuff out of the bill, but as I understand, those sections are that section actually, as I discussed it with folks who know more about that bill than I do. Those provisions weren't operable anyways for the same reasons that Senator Marty just cited, the theater, and there's some other things too, building standards, environmental building standards, et cetera. So at some point, I think we should take a look at some of those that we might want to keep as conditions of public financing for the Mall of America.
Any other discussion? On the A18 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no.
No.
The motion prevails. Other amendments? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair. I have the the A14 amendment.
Senator Dibble moves the A14.
Mr. Chair, this is boiled down to kind of its very bare essentials. The TIF bill that I presented that had to do with areas around transit stations. I think it takes care of some of the major issues that you had, Mr. Chair, as well as the committee had with the original idea that I had. It eliminates the pooling that's available from other districts outside of this area. It eliminates the economic development modification. It simply adds the idea of these transit improvement areas to the, you know, similar to the bioscience areas that we have in districts like redevelopment districts, and make sure that the use of these proceeds is only available confined to those small districts that are around transit districts, or excuse me, transit stations.
Well, Senator Dibble, I appreciate the narrower approach to the idea of the transit improvement district. I guess this will get that subject area as a point of discussion in the conference committee, and
I'm sure the other your counterpart will have some great interest.
We will see how that goes. Discussion, members? Would anybody like to testify on this provision? Seeing no one on
Mr.
the 814. Senator Sedgwick.
My ask is this city specific, or could this be anywhere in Minnesota where these districts may exist?
Council?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sedgwick, this could be anywhere where one of the transit districts or transit improvement areas is established.
Any other discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. The motion prevails. A14 is adopted. Other amendments, members? We have a small oral amendment, members, on the truth in taxation hearings. Council, the page.
Mr. Chairman, members, it's on page 84, line 4. After authority, insert comma, other than a town, comma.
Chair would move that oral amendment. Members, the issue is relative to the truth in taxation meetings that are now going to be held at a regular budget meeting of a city or county. The issue came up about the idea that townships only hold one annual meeting, and it's in March. So this just exempts them from the requirement, the same requirement that cities and counties have. On the oral amendment by the chair, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails. Any other members have any other amendments?
Mr. Chair?
I'm just checking with council to make sure I didn't personally have one that I omitted. Senator Johnson?
My question, is that a stack of amendments we have left to do?
We have some amendments that somebody has requested to be drafted. It wasn't the chair. But if there's something there that's not being offered, it's because whoever requested it to be drafted either forgot to contact a member of the committee, or that committee member is not here at this time.
Or they're not offering it, if they are here.
Or they changed their mind. Any other amendments? If not, members, we're going to move to public testimony on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I have the A9.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, it's being passed out. Mr. Chair, a couple weeks ago when the attorneys were here, you asked everybody that came to the table that day if they had a solution to our budget problem. And there were many offered that day. And you said that you would listen to every solution and bring them to the TAC or to the conference committee, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to hold you to your word. I'd like to bring Racino to the conference committee. The A9 is not the Racino, though, Mr. Chair. It's a combination of two casinos, Running Aces and Canterbury. It's $1,085,000,000 in revenue bonds. And then there's a continuing revenue stream after that. This nice packet that we just got put in front of us contains the amendment, but it also contains the market assessment summary from the innovation group on the revenues that this proposal would draw in.
Yes, ma'am. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, $266 million per biennium. On the next page next to it, I just received today from the Minnesota State Lottery an analysis of this report from Innovation Group. They're confirming that not only will it raise $266 million, it will raise $277 million. That revenue would go to pay for the debt service on the revenue bonds, plus additional to the general fund. Mr. Chairman, $1 billion. And also in the Innovation Group study, if you look, there's 578 jobs created just in the casinos alone. There's an article in there from a veterinarian that says there's a $2.2 million industry in the state of Minnesota. So besides the casino jobs, we're going to be putting a lot of Minnesotans to work. So I contend that this is an economic stimulus package, new jobs, new money, money for education. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to see it go to the conference committee. I'd also like to remind the members of how you say over and over again that these proposals take same dollars and move them around. But, Mr. Chairman, I'll say to you that if Minnesotans have a choice of where to spend those same dollars, they're going to spend them on a revenue stream that comes directly to the state instead of anything that we can possibly capture. So, Mr. Chair, this is a choice bill, an economic stimulus bill, a revenue stream. And I'd like to see it go to conference.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members, Senator Johnson, we had a very lengthy discussion on similar, I'm assuming identical, amendment yesterday offered by Senator Day. And I would certainly hope that the tax committee would reject it for this bill in the same way that the Minnesota Senate rejected it on, I guess it was Senator Tomasoni's bill. As you just acknowledged, Racino at Canterbury will not generate any new jobs, but merely transfer the dwindling gambling revenues and jobs from the lottery, from the pull tab sales, from charitable gambling, as well as the tribal casinos. I mentioned some statistics that are going on around the country in, once again, this period of economic collapse. And regardless of whether you oppose gambling, period, on moral basis, or whether you some people oppose the expansion of gambling, even if you just concentrate on the dollars raised, this is not a good idea for Minnesota. It is not a good risk. Gambling revenues are down all across the country, from Indian casinos, non-Indian. We know that racing, what is the name of it? Running Aces lost a great deal of money last year from just their racing activities. That is typical in other gambling venues as well. Gambling is simply no longer a recession-proof industry. It does not stand outside of the impacts of economic downturns. I quoted yesterday an article from the Denver Post that indicated that a number of casinos in Nevada are facing huge debt burdens and are on the point of bankruptcy. Their revenues are down 23% from 2008. Atlantic City's revenues are down 21%. Connecticut, which has a lot of casinos, are down 15% from 2008. They've canceled the construction of a new casino there that would have brought that cost 1,200 jobs. And Foxwood in Connecticut has laid off 700 employees. Minnesota's casinos, just from the self-reporting that is done by the tribal gambling organizations, indicate that their revenues are down 10% from last year. The state of Kansas lottery made big promises, and they failed to meet their $200 million estimate and were not able to contribute to their state's treasury. Racinos in Indiana had to ask for tax breaks less than a year after opening because their revenues fell so short of projections. Racinos in Delaware and Rhode Island and West Virginia failed to plug state deficits as projected. And I think that, as I said on the floor yesterday, there is no $1 billion here. Not in this economic climate, and this is not a good risk for taxpayers in Minnesota to gamble on gambling. We shouldn't be doing it, and I hope you'll vote no.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Resnow, this is not the same proposal we've seen on the floor last year. This is two facilities. Also, you say that there's no $1 billion here. Actually, I will bet that there is $1.5 billion here because it's on revenue bonds purchased by investors to pay off our current bonds, and other states are having a really easy time selling those bonds. They're flocking to this like $1.50 a gallon gasoline. They are buying and getting investors for these type of bonds with a good revenue source to back them. Also, you keep having to go outside of our own state to get your figures on failing casinos. Unlike, and then you say 10% of the tribal casinos have had a reported loss. Well, that's just what they're telling us. There's nothing making them prove that to us. And I would like to also talk about this piece that Senator Day did hand out on the floor last year that says the casinos nonprofit hand out $1 million. This is from Diamond Joe's in just across the border. They actually are giving our Boy Scouts $3 million a year because they can, and we're not capturing that income. So I'd like to say I'd like to argue with your argument that there's not $1 billion here. I think there's more than $1 billion here, and there certainly is an ongoing revenue source.
So, Senator Johnson, what the amendment proposes to do is add slot machines at Canterbury and Running Aces, and the state sells a $1 billion bond, and the bond is repaid by the machines. Is that right?
That's, Mr. Chair, that is, that's the debt service part.
The revenue off the machines pays for the $1 billion in bonds, but what does the $1 billion in bonds, when we have $1 billion, we issue them, what does that pay for?
Our other bonds, our outstanding bonds. The ones that have to, that are going to come due this year.
So, Senator Johnson, who pays for all the machines?
that are going to get installed in the facilities?
Mr. Chair, the owners.
And they're willing to do that?
I would say so. When you can, if you look on page...
They don't get any revenue then?
Three. Mr. Chair,
why would they do charity for the state?
Senator Rust, if you look on page three of this report from Innovation Group, there's a proceed projection at Canterbury and one at Running Nations of a per day amount. Times those two together, that's 100%. The leasee would get 65%, and the state would get 35%. You multiply that out, and that comes to $266 per biennium. Pays for the debt service.
Is Commissioner Revenue still here? Just wondering what the governor...
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner, I'm curious if the governor has had this proposal in front of him, how the governor feels about putting slot machines at Running Aces or at Canterbury. Does he have a position on that? Hate to put you on the spot, but I think it's helpful to know.
Chairman, members of the committee, this is well outside my expertise. I have not talked to him specifically about this proposal, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask about what his position is relative to this amendment. His view in recent years has been opposition to expansion of gambling, but I have not talked to him in the last 90 days on this issue. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson, do you know?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to make a remark to Commissioner Innes. This is not an expansion of gambling. These are the same dollars choosing to go to a different facility, choosing to have a different outcome, an outcome that will benefit the state.
Yep. And, Chairman, if you want a more definitive answer, I'd be more than happy to try to get somebody from the governor's office or that has actually firsthand knowledge of the position the governor takes.
Commissioner, maybe if you could make a call for us. And Senator Johnson, would you like to know how the governor feels about it before we vote on it? Or?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely not. I think it's up to the... I think it's up to the legislature to decide on a new revenue stream.
Senator Johnson, I have plenty to argue with the governor about in this bill. I'm really not looking for additional baggage that he doesn't want. There's great plenty here already. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Johnson, if you'd like the commissioner to get an answer, we could lay it over and take it up a little later, or if you'd like to just straight up vote on it after what the commissioner said, that either approach is fine with me.
Mr. Chairman, I would like this committee to decide, and I'd like to hold you to what you said a couple weeks ago about new revenue streams going to the conference committee.
We're always looking for revenue, Senator Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chairman.
Would anybody like to testify on the amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
I had proposed something like this a few years back, and the governor kind of bought into that, and I remember Dan McElroy referring to it as the Langseth proposal. And I think that cut some of the poor tribes in on it and so on. But I voted for Dick Day's proposal the other day. But, boy, this is kind of a full plate here to be putting on today. I guess I'll vote against it today, even though I kind of think you probably got the right idea.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to oppose the vote against the amendment, but I just have to say that I have a lot of respect for Senator Johnson for being able to say we're the legislature, and it's up to us to make some decisions around here, and that, you know, it doesn't matter which side of the aisle you come from, or it doesn't matter if it's a proposal by a senator offered in a Senate committee that we make that decision. And Senator Johnson, I really respect you for taking that position.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair and members, as I said on the floor the other day, I think it's, the time has come. I mean, if not now, when? $6.4 billion budget deficit. We've got the data here which suggests that there's a 70% favorability index on moving forward in certainly this area. Senator Johnson pointed out that $266 million of new money, a biennium. That's absolutely huge. How can we turn our backs on that? Mr. Chair, you asked for ideas yesterday, and you've asked for ideas, I think, probably since January 7th, and this is an idea, and this is a big one. And this is one we ought to take a real long look at, and in my opinion, let's get it in the conference. Let's have the debate there, and let's involve the governor in this, but let's find out if this state wants to move forward in this area. I, as I said on the floor the other day, you know, we all do our little radio shows, and invariably, at least when I do mine in Rochester, I get a call about why aren't we doing this, and what can you tell them? You know, it's not a good idea yet, but Mr. Chair, it is a good idea. We ought to move forward. I happened to spend a Sunday at Running Aces last summer. It was a great day. Made $188, and how could it be any greater than that? But beyond there, maybe a couple thousand people, maybe even more than that. The place seemed full to me, and they were enjoying this. They were having fun. They were betting, and we can enhance that experience with some slot machines and giving these facilities a chance to go forward and to make some money, to be able to bring the horses in and to build his industry. 500 and some jobs, as it says here, and I think at least at Canterbury, they're all unionized. So there are opportunities here, and let's not let this one go by.
Senator Senjum, as long as we're all bearing our soul about how we feel about gambling, I remember very well in 1988 when the lottery was on the ballot, and I wasn't a legislator. And I remember going into the voting booth and voting no, because I just don't believe the state should be in the gambling business. I just, and lots of good work has been done with that revenue, but it also has brought a lot of cost. It that money is not free. And I will always remember pulling up to the gas pump at the little gas station in Cook where I buy my gas, and standing in front of me in line was a young fellow, probably 18 years old, and he handed the store clerk $5, and he used $3 for gas and bought $2 worth of lottery tickets. And I went to the window to look what kind of vehicle he was getting in, and it was a rusty old pickup truck. And I thought to myself, what was that individual thinking? That it was more important to gamble than to invest that money in maybe a little better vehicle than he had. And what are we teaching young people when we teach them you can hit the mother load without having to go to work? I just think there's a real mentality problem developing when we teach young people that you don't have to work hard to get ahead, that somehow you can get ahead by rolling the dice. And I just don't think the state should be promoting that. So I've never been a supporter of expanded gambling. It has nothing to do with Running Aces or Canterbury. I've been to Canterbury. I think it's a wonderful facility. And for people that want to enjoy it, there's ample opportunity to gamble in Minnesota. And in fact, the former tax chair of this committee is in Laughlin as we speak. flew out yesterday with his wife and another couple. There's plenty of opportunity to do that, but getting the state into it is something I just have had a hard time getting my arms around.
Mr. Chair, can I just say, I think, and you're right, certainly there are problems with the gambling. There are virtually problems with everything, but those problems I don't believe are going to be enhanced a lot by going forward with this proposal. If those problems exist, they already exist, and that's unfortunate. But the fact is, many people attend these, go to these kind of events, go to these kind of places. They enjoy it. They're not compulsive gamblers. They go, as Senator Day said, they spend their $20 and they go home and they've had a good time. I mean, literally, out of my hometown, there's buses going every which way to different sites, and they all go voluntarily. And they all come back on many occasions, even perhaps having lost money, but say it was a good day. So, again, I hope we can go forward with this.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I would just say that there's gambling all over the state of Minnesota already. I went and played bingo one time. I didn't actually like it very much. I couldn't track all of my cards at the same time, and I was behind, I'll be honest. And so I couldn't have won even if my card was a winner because I just wasn't paying attention. But there's gambling all over the state, and we are not capturing any of the revenues. And so it seems to me that if we're having an economic crisis, We should be looking at all of the different options. The gambling will continue, and we can just choose not to capture the revenues, or we can choose to send those buses out of state, or we can step up here and say, no, we should be looking at all sources of revenues before we ask Minnesota taxpayers to sacrifice some more. I heard two arguments against this today that I want to address. The first was that this would not be a good risk for taxpayers. What risk for the taxpayers? There's no risk for the taxpayers. If people are willing to put the money in the slot machine, just like they're willing to put it down on the race, or they're willing to put it down somewhere else, why is that a risk for the taxpayers? It's not. So let them subsidize the state's budget. There's no risk at all for the taxpayers. It might not generate as much as Senator Rest might like or as Senator Johnson might think, but there's certainly no risk to the taxpayers. Secondly, I heard that gambling is not a recession-proof industry. Please tell me what is. I can think of two. I can think of pawnbrokers and government. They're all doing just fine. But not the other industries in Minnesota, and we're ready to crunch them. We're ready to go take every last dollar, every last investment dollar out of those businesses and out of families. But we've got a philosophical objection to gambling. I think that's unbelievable. I think we should put this revenue on the table and consider it, just like you considered a proposal, Mr. Chair, for a project up in your district. Let's just move it on to the conference committee so it's in play at the end of the day. I think we should do that here if we've got some real credibility about what we're trying to do and what our goals are.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Since Senator Ortman was referring to some comments I made, that the risk to taxpayers is believing in a dream that's not going to come true. It's the risk to taxpayers is believing that by opening up a couple of racinos that we are going to solve our budget crisis. That's the risk. Not that they might make a few dollars, but we don't even know that. We truly don't know that. The report that we have here is not from the Department of Revenue. And then secondly, you just said that government is not recession-proof. I beg to differ. We are facing a $6 billion deficit. We definitely are not recession-proof. I truly don't understand that comment, Senator Ortman, but this is not a good deal for Minnesotans. It's not a good deal for Minnesota taxpayers and for the future of our state, and we should just say no.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair.
You get the last word.
No one has suggested that gambling will solve the budget deficit. But it will help contribute to the solution, and it's a way better solution than taking money out of hardworking Minnesotans' pockets who can't afford it. And I think you have to make a choice here. You have to realize you are making a choice between voluntary contributions of tax revenues versus the enforced sacrifice against Minnesotans who can't afford this. Government is becoming recession-proof because we're going to raise all the taxes we need to continue our spending. It's completely recession-proof. That's the plan, and that's what makes this tax bill not a budget bill, but a policy bill. We will continue with our current direction in spending. We'll resolve the structural deficit, and it doesn't matter what the cost to Minnesotans.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I wish your logic was equal to your passion, for heaven's sake.
Senator Ortman, it's just not true. That government's going to continue to spend at levels that they've spent at. This bill, even if the governor would assign this bill, there is going to be a 7% cut in state spending all over state government. Not growing, 7% less. We've had the spending bills up on the floor. It's not quite fair to characterize that government's on autopilot and it's continuing to grow, because that's not going to happen in this session. Even with this bill, there's a 7% cut. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, you've made my point. We've been talking all day about putting a bill on the table for the conference committee, including the budget bills with 7% cuts. I have no reason to believe that that's what's going to happen at the end of the day, and nor does anybody in the state of Minnesota.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to reiterate that this is just a partial solution.
and all pieces should be considered.
On the Johnson motion to adopt the A9 amendment.
Mr. Chair, roll call.
Roll call is being requested.
No.
Johnson? Yes.
No.
Limmer? No.
Marty? No.
No.
Ortman? Yes.
Hogan-Miller? No.
Jess? No.
Yes.
No.
Chair? Chair votes no. On a vote of 9 against and 3 for, the amendment is not adopted. Members, the chair has one. Senator Dibble, the chair has one oral amendment. The issue in Senator Murphy's bill that we had in front of us earlier today, with the transit tax issue that we were carrying in a duplicative way in this bill, I think we'll count on Senator Murphy to carry that transit tax. So, and I understand it's the same language being carried in the transportation bill as here. So the chair would move to delete section 42, which is the same language that the transportation bill carried that we passed out of here earlier today.
The transportation bill only had this part. You only had this part. You didn't have that additional. That's okay. This part was included in there.
That's what it
is. Yes, we're taking this whole section.
Senator Dibble, is that all right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to be clear to the members, that's the levy that the Met Council that we authorized the Met Council to do in order to support its debt service, and we had also given them some flexibility to use some of those dollars for operating, but that's in the transportation bill.
And members, I had put it in the draft of the bill, not knowing that the transportation bill was carrying it, but I had committed to Senator Dibble that I would try and make transit a discussion of the conference committee on the tax bill. But having seen the provision in the transportation bill, that doesn't appear to be necessary. On the chair's motion to delete section 42 on page 103 and 104. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no. The motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I do apologize. Senator Chaudhry had asked for the A4 amendment to be prepared. He is not here, and his staff has come to me and asked if I would move the A4 amendment. The city manager and the development director in connection to this project are here today, and I figured if they have made the time to be here, I'd like to move the A4 amendment and give them a chance to argue, make their case for this language. I apologize to the members. I don't know very much about this project, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wong moves the A4 on behalf of Senator Chaudhry. Representatives from the city.
I believe the city manager and the development director.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Senator Bach, I'm Dean Lauder. I'm the city manager of New Brighton, and with me is Grant Fernelius, our community development director for the city of New Brighton. I appreciate the amendment offering. Thank you, Senator. What I'll do is just briefly introduce it, and I'd like to just state for the record that this is an ideal piece of legislation for this venue because it won't cost any money at all. And it's a situation that's occurred as a result of a development project in the city of New Brighton. It has to do with the relocation of a railroad spur. And I'd like to just defer to Grant Fernelius, and he's been the project manager on this project, and he'll speak to the committee about the details.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just very briefly.
Your name, Mr. Cornelius.
Grant Fernelius, the community development director for the city of New Brighton. Mr. Chair and members, the city of New Brighton in 2005 received a $1 million grant from the state that was approved by the legislature at the time to help alleviate coal train traffic primarily, as well as some other freight train traffic in the community.
And in order to accomplish that, a eastbound railroad Y connection had to be built to help alleviate this traffic. There were a number of blocked crossings, public safety issues, just general inconveniences for residents of New Brighton. And in working with the railroad since that time to try and make this project a reality, one of the things that we have discovered is that the city actually has to own the railroad Y track. It's a fairly unusual situation. And that has created some consequences for the city, particularly as it relates to tax implications. And so one of the things that we did in talking with the Department of Revenue to try and clarify this issue was to work towards an exemption for this kind of project. And so I believe the amendment that you have before you provides some criteria that must be met in order for the exemption to work. It's fairly narrowly defined, would include projects that are publicly owned, funded in whole or in part by state grants, located in the metro area, generally a track that's less than 2,500 feet in length, which is what the Railroad Y project is, and connects intersecting rail lines. And then lastly, tracks that would be built or constructed after January 1st of 2009. So those general parameters fit for the project that we're working on and will help us achieve what we're trying to accomplish.
Questions, members? On the A4 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A4 is adopted. Mr. Lauder, Mr. Cornelius, thank you for coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Other amendments, members of the committee? Seeing none, we have a list of people who want to testify on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
At some point, I wanted to remind you that I was hoping the Department of Revenue would talk about the property tax provisions.
We've got a list, and then we have some names added. Joel Witt from the Minnesota Bankers Association. And in order to expedite this, how about Jill Larson from the Partnership and Tom Hesse from the Chamber? Welcome to the committee. Mr. Witt, we'll
begin
with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I was here to testify on Article 1, Section 10 of the bill, and I did have a handout if I could maybe have somebody help me with that. The handout is a letter that's been drafted on behalf of numerous organizations that oppose, including Article 1, Section 10, the surtax on certain interest income in the Senate tax bill. I did have an opportunity to testify on this bill before. I discussed mostly commerce issues. We think that the proposal would dry up credit and make credit more expensive. I won't discuss those issues again because I did have a chance to talk about those already. Today I wanted to make 3 points, and I will be brief to make sure that I'm respectful of your time, Mr. Chair and committee members. My first point is that this proposal is likely unconstitutional. It's written into the income tax code as an amendment to the income tax section. However, it's not an income tax. From a business standpoint, an income tax looks at gross revenues, subtracts off operating expenses, and really is a tax on your profits or your bottom line. This proposal is very different. It is essentially an unapportioned gross receipts tax. It only focuses on the revenue side. It does not look at taxing profits. For that reason, we believe it would be unconstitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court has held that gross receipt taxes are unconstitutional, and this bill would certainly be challenged. Second point I'd like to raise is that the revenue note assumes that credit card issuers would pay the majority of the taxes that are generated by this proposal. There are very complicated rules on nexus for whether or not an out-of-state lender would have to pay taxes in the state of Minnesota, and it is very likely that this proposal would net the types of dollars that are involved because of the facts that nexus would likely not be not be exercised over those out-of-state lenders. And as I talked about in the committee last time around, there really are no in-state Minnesota credit card issuers because of some of our other policies that we've adopted here in the state. Third point that I wanted to make is that this bill also attempts to pass the tax liability onto assinees and transferees of the original loans that are viewed as taxable under this surtax bill. As much as 50% of all credit card debt is securitized, packaged up, and then sold off to investor groups. Issuers basically bundle up thousands of accounts, and they sell the right to repayment on those accounts to an investor. They take their money up front, and the investor receives the income over time. It's sort of like establishing an annuity. Who would ultimately receive the income from the credit card payments would determine who is ultimately responsible for the tax. So who buys these securities? Institutional investors buy them, cities, counties, 401k funds, and pension funds. So let's look at an example of how this would work in the pension example. Let's say you have a retired pipe fitter who gets a pension every month from the pipe fitters union. He gets $1,000 a month from the pension, which has invested money into stocks, bonds, and income-producing securities. He is ultimately the person that receives the income from those loans that were made. Do we really think that he is going to track every year how much of his pension income came from these types of securities that have credit card debts within them, and then also track how much of that income came from Minnesota, and then also track how much of the income that's from Minnesota was over 15%. And then, if he did all that, would he pay 30% of the income that he received from that type of loan back to the state? I think that portion of the bill is completely unrealistic and probably, again, would have very difficult time trying to establish a nexus between a pension participant whose pension happened to purchase these securities. Again, I want to state that we do oppose this section of the bill. We think it's bad from a public policy standpoint. We also think that it uses the tax code to pick winners and losers in the marketplace. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Ms. Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. A couple of specific issues I'd like to comment on. One is the proposal to stop the phase-in to the 100% sales factor for apportioning corporate income taxes. The proposal to freeze that at the current 2008 rate is very concerning to us. Moving to 100% sales factor has been a longstanding bipartisan policy of the legislature, and we're very concerned that this stops the momentum to get to this policy, which is a very good economic development proposal. As I think many of you know, many other states have already moved to 100% sales factor. I think currently maybe 14 states are already at 100%, and that's a huge increase from just since 2005. I think there were only maybe seven states then. So many, many states are moving in that direction. And, in fact, I think Wisconsin got there in 2008. If we stop the phase-in now, other states are going to have a more favorable apportionment factor, and they're going to get more investment and more job growth. And so we would hope that as this bill moves through conference, that that proposal is able to be removed from the bill. Also, well, we can appreciate the proposals you did put in, Mr. Chairman, upfront capital equipment exemption. We support that and appreciate that. Support the small business tax credits that are in the bill. We think that single sales is also a broad economic development proposal that will have a positive impact on a wide range of businesses, on Minnesota businesses. We also oppose the increase in the statewide property tax and the shift of the tax by removing cabins from the levy. I think you all know that employers still pay some of the highest property taxes in the country. The latest research I've looked at says that statewide, on average, I think commercial property taxes are going up around 8% statewide. They're going up much more than homesteads are, and with the home values dropping, we're getting more of a shift onto CI property as well. So that's a concern. And we also do oppose the income tax increases in the bill. We already are a high income tax state. We have a very progressive income tax already. The new fourth bracket will put us at, I think, something like the fourth highest rate in the country. And what my members tell me is that the high rates do have a negative impact on recruiting top talent here. That is a real issue. I just got an email from one of my members 2 days ago that a real-time, real example of they have four global business units across the country. Two of them are located here. The person that leads that unit is currently retiring, and their lead candidate is an out-of-state candidate. And this candidate has brought up to the company the issue of Minnesota's high taxes as a detriment to taking the job here. The issue is they can move that global business unit to one of the other states where the other three units are. They could do that. It's in a state that has a lower cost of living, good quality of life, and so that is something that they are considering. So I just caution you as this moves forward that we look at the potential impact of these increased income taxes on bringing new jobs to Minnesota. The last thing I want to mention is, just to go on the record, this has gotten a lot of discussion, but we also do oppose the surtax on interest and the provision in the bill, that the so-called Amazon.com tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First, I want to talk about a few of the things that we appreciate you including in the bill. First, obviously, is the upfront exemption for capital equipment purchases. That's been a long-standing item that we would like to see taken care of, so thank you for that. Also, we support the Minnesota Business Investment Company credit. That provision will create a pool of capital that small businesses can access. We think that also is an important feature that will allow some small companies in the state to either deal with succession issues or expansion issues, so thank you for that. And then the amendment this afternoon on the exemption for pass-through income, I think that's certainly another positive feature of the bill. Having said that, we have a number of issues that we oppose. First and foremost, the increase in the statewide property tax. I think I've talked about that provision a number of years in a row. We think the current structure of the statewide property tax should be retained. It's a fixed dollar amount that's annually adjusted for inflation. It grows every year, and that structure is what we think again should be retained in the state. We do not want to see the structure change to a fixed tax rate. We also oppose the utility class rate provisions, bumping those up. And again, I've spoken on that in years past. Third, the income tax provisions. You know, most of our members are smaller companies that pass through their income through their personal returns. So a income tax increase certainly will hit those companies and their employees. Fourth or fifth, the freeze of single sales factor apportionment, as Ms. Larson stated. That's a policy that has had bipartisan support from the legislature. It helps companies in Minnesota that sell nationally to stay here and invest more in Minnesota and employ more people. And then the final two issues are, again, the interest tax that we testified at length on previously, and also the Amazon tax. We oppose both of those provisions. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse.
Thank you.
Next, let's have Buzz Anderson, Kay Ryko, and Alyssa Shalander.
Apologies, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association. Been a lot of good comments made already, so I will make my comments very brief. I do want to state for the record, however, that as retailers, we do oppose Article 1, Section 10, the portion of the bill that imposes a 30% income tax on interest over 15%. I can't really say any better than what Mr. Witt said, except to say that credit is extremely important to retailers and their customers. This will make matters much worse. It'll reduce consumer spending at absolutely the wrong time.
Article 3, Section 2, another issue that we have concerns about. And, Mr. Chair, I want to say your instincts in this one are absolutely right. Retailers are taken to the cleaners by Internet sellers, and they, as brick-and-mortar retailers, are really at a severe disadvantage. So our members have really struggled with this one because of that very problem. Our concern, however, as we review this in retrospect, is that doing this at the state legislative level may, in fact, hurt our efforts to get a streamlined sales tax agreement passed. And we're very, very – this is a very, very important move for us. We think it's probably going to have to be done at the federal level first in Congress before the states can actually do this. Otherwise, you're going to end up in very long, very prolonged court battles. I would say this. We know that Senator Ensign and Congressman Delahunt are actually introducing the bill very shortly. It has a very good chance of passage this year, and we think with that passage, then the legislature ought to, in fact, authorize the taxing of Internet sales. Article 4, Section 18. There's also been a concern raised about this increasing the statewide property tax. We are concerned about what, in fact, that will do, again, to businesses at a time when the economy is very, very bad. And increasing our property taxes is not a good thing to do. So with that, I will keep my comments very short and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NIA, representing the interests of commercial real estate developers, owners, and managers, along with the tens of thousands of businesses that are in the buildings that we own and manage across the state. And I'm here to address the changes to the statewide general property tax, which will result in yet another increase in property tax for Minnesota's employers. And, you know, I know you guys have heard this a lot, but there's a tremendous amount of frustration out there right now with business owners and managers. I mean, you can hear it in their voices when they talk about the fact that they have to reduce their operating costs by 10 to sometimes 20%. And these aren't decreases in increases. These are actual reductions in the amount of money that they have available to operate. And the owners and managers of the buildings that we work with right now, they spend a huge amount of their time every day renegotiating leases, helping tenants, reducing costs, reducing space. And, of course, as you know, one way that employers are reducing costs is by laying off people or giving them a temporary, you know, temporary vacation or forced time off. And I do agree with Senator Bach's comments from yesterday, and he is absolutely right when he says that now is not the time to raise fixed costs on Minnesota's employers by raising their property taxes by yet even a greater amount. And I think it is important to remind everybody once again, as Ms. Larson did, that Minnesota's employers are scheduled for an 8% increase in property taxes this year, and of that, 6.1% is the increase that they are paying into the state general fund via the statewide general property tax. And I also would like to add regarding that the statewide general tax is now calculated in the same basic way that local property taxes are collected. You determine how much money you need to raise, you set the rate, and then you apply that against your base. So I would ask that if you want to increase the money that's paid into the state general fund by the statewide property tax, that you determine the amount of money that you want to raise it by and adjust the rate and then spread the rate over the properties that are impacted. At least that's transparent, and the property taxpayers understand that because that's the method that they're used to. And I just thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Schlander?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I represent the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. Mr. Chair, I'll keep my comments very brief. I only want to reiterate my opposition to Senator Ortman's provision in the bill, which taxes interest interest rates, which exceed 15%. I just will briefly just reiterate, Mr. Chair, credit is priced according to risk, and that's primarily based on credit score. So when we are trying to sell a car to a customer whose credit score requires risk-based pricing, we're not making a profit on the financing of that vehicle, but this tax would apply to the interest that we're supposedly charging. Mr. Chair, what we're trying to do in that situation is trying to make a profit on the sale of the vehicle in that situation. But if we cannot find financing for customers who are going to be buying these vehicles are not going to be buying these vehicles. So whether we pay this 30% tax or the lender pays the 30% tax, it doesn't really matter. Because if there's no profit left in the sale of the vehicle, that is just a sale that is just not going to happen. We'll just simply not be able to sell to risk-based customers. Senator Ortman has said, others have said, that maybe that's just fine, that we wouldn't be able to extend credit to certain customers. But I will tell you that this would represent a quarter to a third of the used car market in our dealerships, and that is a very big deal to our members. Mr. Chair, what I can tell you for sure is that the sales that we do not make have a direct correlation in the jobs we do not have. We've seen it over the last 5 years, and the sales have absolutely dropped off a cliff in the last 8 months, and that has had a direct effect on the number of store closings we've experienced and the number of jobs that we have lost in this industry. So I would just briefly say one more time, this provision will result in people paying more to buy less, in people having fewer options with respect to flexibility and being able to structure their monthly car payment, and ultimately will just require us to turn away customers. And there is nothing that makes our dealers more sick right now than the prospect of having to turn away customers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Elizabeth Weifel, Ethan Roberts, and Nan Matt.
Excuse me, with respect, if it would be possible for me to speak a little bit later with Elaine Keith and Marcia Avner, my testimony is more appropriate with their testimony because it's with regard to the same issue.
Okay. Sure.
Thank you.
Should we kind of lump together here? Well, Ms. Weifel, let's start with you.
Okay. My name is Elizabeth Weifel, and I'm with Flaherty in Hood, speaking on behalf of the Coalition of Utility Cities. We just wanted to speak briefly in favor of the change to the utility class rates. The change in the valuation of utility property as a result of the Department of Revenue changes resulted in a nearly $34 million tax shift to homeowners and business owners. We appreciate the transition aid that the legislature came up with as a solution to this problem. We do have concerns with it, though, however, because it is not a stable source of revenue when we are facing record budget deficits, and it also does not include everyone in the solution, including counties and other cities that did not quite meet the threshold. Finally, we just wanted to point out that we had for those who don't understand why these host communities face special burdens, we had two very real examples within the last week at two separate coal facilities located within our cities. There were two fires within the last week, including one in Cohasset that burned for 13 hours and took 40 firefighters to fight with some special equipment that our small city of 2,700 people had to purchase. So these are significant burdens imposed on our cities. We would also like to speak in favor of the changes to the pollution control exemption rule. It is an outdated rule that was created in 1967 before there were regulations around these types of facilities, and the legislature since then has adopted other methods to allow utilities to recover some of these costs through rate riders. And finally, the pollution control exemption consumes a significant and growing portion of the market value in these cities. Right now, it represents nearly 35% in one city, and it is continuing to grow as these facilities are being upgraded.
Thank you. Ms.
Madden. Thank you.
Chair Bach and members of the committee, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I'd like to start off by thanking the committee for the amendment earlier that removed the governor's cuts to the renter's credit from this bill. That provision would have had a significant impact on low-income folks across the state, and I very much appreciate that is no longer in this bill. I also want to express my appreciation for the efforts of the Senate to take a balanced approach to the state's budget shortfall. I really applaud the goal in your work here to restore balance to the tax system and to respond to dramatic increases in regressivity. Clearly, we're in a budget situation where we're making choices that we'd rather not have to make. But obviously, it's not a choice between raising taxes or doing nothing. It's a choice between raising taxes or further damaging the state's ability to adequately fund health care, education, services for the disabled, job training, and those other services that make a really important difference in people's lives, and especially right now as families are struggling. So I really appreciate the effort that you're making for a balanced approach to the state's budget shortfall.
Thank you. Let's try Elaine Keefe, Marsha Abner, and Ethan Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marsha Abner. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. On behalf of MCN's over 1,950 member organizations and on behalf of public charities, we appreciate the committee's attention to the standards for nonprofit property tax exemption. This issue has been before you for 2 years. Following a December 2007 court decision that changed the long-standing factors considered by assessors and nonprofits, the legislature passed a moratorium that prohibited any real change in assessment practices and charged MCN, the Department of Revenue, and the assessors with working together to find a fair standard and to ensuring that we neither expand nor contract the property tax exemption. We did that. The three parties, as well as county attorneys, legislative staff, hundreds of nonprofits, spent much of the past year collaborating on a proposal that meets that requirement. We held over 16 formal meetings, countless calls and small meetings, and I think we broke a record. We had 24 drafts of the proposal. Keep in mind where we started. Under the 34-year precedent of the North Star case, and even under the stricter rule in the Under the Rainbow case, there has never been a requirement that all six of the North Star factors be met. North Star and the cases that follow use those six factors as guidelines, with no factor as critical or determinative, and many charities with existing exemptions miss at least one of those factors. The proposal that we presented to the division and that was passed in division provides consistency and clarity to nonprofits. It provides clarity to assessors, and as the department will report, their survey of assessors, also mandated by the legislature, showed that they are all across the board on practices. We now moved from the position of saying our first position, which was no single factor shall be determinative, to a cautious agreement that all six factors are presumed to be in place, but because no two nonprofits are identical, if there is a reasonable justification for a nonprofit to not meet factor 2, 3, or 5, that the assessor could still grant the exemption. And I'm referring specifically to the language that you have in Article 4, Section 5 and Section 55, lines 69.7, 69.8, and 110.38. We now have a very serious concern about a change that was introduced yesterday morning when the omnibus tax bill was introduced. That bill changes the term reasonable justification to compelling factual reason. And this change, while on the face of it may seem to be only a semantic difference, in reality shifts the overall balance of the statute to one that we are convinced would severely contract the current exemptions. It is a serious change. In Minnesota law, reasonable justification is often used compelling factual reason is a significantly higher bar. In fact, it is almost always only used with constitutional issues. This high bar disrupts the balance that we thought we had achieved in presuming that all six standards would be expected to be met, but that a reasonable explanation for not meeting 2, 3, or 5 would allow the assessors the necessary discretion to still grant the exemption. All through the process, as we met with revenue and the assessors, we asked the question, will the types of groups that are currently and have long been exempt still be exempt? And will those that have often been out still be out? We've applied that test now. An organization may miss 2 or 3 and be exempt with a reasonable justification. For instance, that the rate it charges for clients for habilitation services are set by government. Or it might be a situation where the organization is mandated to provide a particular program. Or it might be an organization that is founded as a house for multiple nonprofit organizations with similar missions, and it charges below market rent. These are reasonable. But we believe and have consulted with many of the attorneys who work with nonprofits who believe that with the high bar of compelling factors or facts, the courts would be left to determine what that really means. What does it mean to rise to the level of a compelling factual issue? I'll cite just one example. I know that time is short. Imagine a residential care facility, one that serves people with spinal cord injury. Budget of $11 million. Most of its support, fixed amounts of federal funds. The rates for service are set by the federal government. Therefore, it can't meet that test of providing free or below-cost goods or services. It receives only $100,000 out of $11 million in private donations. It has a constituency that doesn't do fundraising. Because of the nature of the organization, they have always and should continue to make the case that they don't meet prongs 2 or prong 3, but they're clearly what we all expect to see as a purely public charity. It's a reasonable test. No one has been able to explain whether or not they would meet the compelling facts test. We frankly at the Council of Nonprofits, and we've consulted throughout with hundreds of our members, would never have supported this language in trying to reach an agreement. We would not have moved along with revenue and with the assessors on the presumption that all six factors must be present, but that there was still the option to present a reasonable justification for not meeting 2, 3, or 5. We urge you to return to the language that was presented and passed in the division, and it is the language that is included in the House tax bill. This is very important to the nonprofit sector, and we hope that you will respect the hard work that went into a workable resolution to the problem, one that revenue and the assessors and we think is fair and meets your test of neither expanding nor contracting the tax exemption. And I will add that Commissioner Ines did want to comment on this as well.
Well, Ms. Avner, we've had a lot of discussion around this committee table about the amount of discretion that assessors have. And I'm a little uncomfortable using the words reasonable justification. It seems like there's a lot of discretion in that. So I do think what we need to get in the conference committee is some testimony on the record by the assessors and by the department about what the words reasonable justification mean. In the event that somebody files another lawsuit and we have another rainbow decision, I think we need to get a good explanation of what the legislative intent over what those words mean. Not that we're trying to change the current practice, because I'm not interested in doing that, but I do think we have to establish some additional intent, not in some 30 meetings that happened inside or outside the Capitol, but didn't happen in really the open meeting process where there is a permanent record established. So it's not that it's not my intent to change the North Star test. It's just that we make it clear where there's exceptions made, that we give assessors some direction over what the terms are under which they consider the exemptions to the test. So I want to, Ms. Avner, I want to get, it's not that I don't think reasonable justification might not be the right words, but I do think we need some testimony on the record from the department and from the assessors as to what that means, because there's, at some point in time, there's going to be another lawsuit. And we need to, I think we would do all parties some good, I think, to get some additional clarification of what the intent of those words is.
Mr. Chair, we respect that need, and as testimony was provided by the department in the division, they are in the process of developing a memorandum that clarifies in great detail and with case examples covering a wide field, a memorandum to be given to the assessors to bring even greater clarity and to try to avoid having to test this in court. That will, of course, be available to you and to the conferees, and we have been working toward that clarity. I do hope today that Commissioner Innes will have a moment to speak to it, and I believe that Tom May is here. I don't know if he was planning to testify.
I think, Ms. Avner, we'll have ample opportunity to hear from them in the conference committee, but it is our intent just to make sure we all understand what reasonable justification means. Ms. Keefe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Elaine Keefe representing Greater Twin Cities United Way. And we also participated in the working group that negotiated the language clarifying standards for property tax exemptions for charitable institutions. And we thank you for including the language in the tax bill. However, we also share the concerns that the Council of Nonprofits has raised about the change that was made from a reasonable justification to compelling factual reason. And, Mr. Chair, I take some comfort in the remarks that you made about seeking clarity. I mean, that was part of our goal in crafting this language, was to have clarity so that nonprofits and charitable institutions know what's expected of them, and also so that there's greater consistency in the practices among the assessors. So it sounds to me like we're on the same page. But we are concerned that this change might have the effect of contracting the definition of institution of purely public charity, which is clearly contrary to the intent of this language. So we look forward to working with you on this.
Thank you.
Ethan Roberts, Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and Dakotas. I'm also an elected board member for Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. And I, too, have participated in a lot of these meetings and conversations and developing what we presented as a consensus bill. And you know, there's a lot of interest, of course, not only in the Minnesota's nonprofit community, but also I think it's important to note that nationally, the country is watching what we do here. There have been articles stretching back from the New York Times to more recently in the Chronicle of Philanthropy. But I was in the division committee hearing, Chairman Bach, when you raised the concern, and I think it's an absolutely justifiable concern, that are we creating a huge hole in the statute that would allow a truck to go through. I'm not sure if that was the analogy you used or not. And when we were in these meetings, one thing we would often discuss is, would the actual child care center in the Under the Rainbow case, the Under the Rainbow Child Care Center, how would they fare under this bill, under the language that we have crafted? And speaking not only, I think, for myself, but for the people who are there, I am confident that they would fail, that they would not be granted the exemption, that it is not reasonable under the circumstances for them not to provide a sliding fee child care option, for them not to provide scholarships, for them not to raise monies from the community. And so I think using the very real-world example of the very defendant in the case that brought us here and using the language which we crafted, I feel good about that, because we are not here to expand the definition and the exemption. I represent at least one nonprofit that is exempt and would be exempt that does provide sliding fee child care or and scholarships and raises money, we can do that. So when you get testimony from the Department of Revenue and from the county assessors, I would ask them specifically about Under the Rainbow itself and how they would fare under this test. And hopefully, Chairman Bach and members of the committee, that will give you the assurance that the language that we crafted is sufficient to meet your needs without having to go to the language of really which comes under strict scrutiny under the con law of, you know, compelling governmental interest, which really is a very, very hard standard to meet. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you recall, when we heard this bill, I had some concerns about, you know, particular kind of entity that is in my district. I've since that time have had some conversations with Council on Nonprofits and the folks who run the Historic Theater Trust, and I think they would continue to be considered a charitable nonprofit and continue to receive the property tax exemption as Ms. Avner described, though no two nonprofits are exactly alike, and they're different enough that, you know, I think they do, there are compelling factual reasons perhaps that we can look to ensure that they meet these tests, but I'm not certain of that. And so I was prepared today to ask some questions either of revenue or the assessors, just to establish for the record. Sounds like you want to wait to do that in conference, and whether or not I'm on the conference committee, I'd like an opportunity perhaps to do that, because I think with the new language, I'm now back to being pretty nervous again. So if we can have some time in conference committee perhaps, and I won't do that today. Like I said, I think they continue to meet the test, but I think we need to be absolutely sure, because I think organizations like that should continue to receive their property tax exemption.
Thank you. Christine Berger and Annette Henkel. Hi, Christine. Ms. Berger lobbied me yesterday on the provision I think you're going to talk about, and I didn't think I scared her off, but... Mr. Galler, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Galler with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. We're just going to address one issue. Issue you talked about earlier, as Senator Rest brought forward her A1 amendment dealing with mortgage interest deduction for second homes in the state of Minnesota. The association's against it. We think it's a strong part of the real estate community itself, not to mention that many of those folks have homes that aren't worth what they were in the past. One of the things about the mortgage interest deduction isn't only on the acquisition of those properties, but in greater Minnesota, they oftentimes have to take out additional loans, second loans, sometimes the primary loan, to do work on septic systems, wells, maintenance on the property that they don't use on a regular basis. By denying them that, that's going to make it even harder for them to, A, get financing for those, to make those repairs that we know are necessary, especially in the case of septic systems and wells, where we have significant environmental issues on the lakes in greater Minnesota. Right now, as you know, the marketplace is already in a difficult position, and we don't like the unpredictability that this enters into the marketplace. These are generally consumers that want to know that the investment they're making in housing is going to be a good, strong investment for not only their use, but also for the communities and as an investment into the future. So we would hope that you would withdraw that particular segment of the bill. And other than that, I'm done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Annette Hinkle, and I'm president of the Minnesota Utility and Minnesota Utility Investors. And I'm testifying in opposition to Article 4, Section 16 in the tax bill. And this is not an issue that's new, certainly to you. It's the we have had a longstanding tradition in opposition to the increase in the class rate for the personal property tax. And I want to just be officially on the record, but in addition to the opposition to the increase, this particular provision does not allow for cost recovery. For this in particular, hits my members from both sides. As ratepayers, our members are small energy users. They pay their electric and gas bills that pay this increase or this personal property tax, but they are also shareholders. They will bear the burden of this increase in this tax, in this hidden tax, and that is a concern. You know who our members are. They're older. predominantly retired people, many times living off the pay their living expenses with the dividend and the success of these utilities. So we're not asking you to eliminate the personal property tax. We want to be very clear, but we want to provide but we are very clear we're asking you not to increase the personal property tax.
Thank you, Ms. Henkel.
Thank you.
Steve Peterson, Keith Carlson, Joe Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. I know you've been here a long time, so I'll be real brief. I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. AMC does support the increase in the utility class rate. There's also provision in here to increase the threshold for making one payment for your property taxes instead of two, increasing that up to $250. AMC supported that. We also thank you for your repeal of the levy limits. That's been an issue for us. We really feel strongly that counties make better funding decisions when they're able to do so locally without the imposition of the state's will. And finally, I want to thank you for, in this tough budget time, recognizing the importance of the local aids and credits. Counties, obviously, with county program aid, it's a key part of our budget. There are some modest decreases to that. We're willing to do our part to help out. I just want to thank you for your deference in that area. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Keith Carlson with Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I also want to thank you for the moderation in the aid cuts in the bill, plus continuing to use levy plus aids as the basis for distributing those aid cuts. We're very grateful for what you did with repealing the levy limits, as well as the truth and taxation hearing, the suspension of the advertisement. Those last two items will save cities, counties, and school districts approximately $670,000. So any savings that we can receive is greatly appreciated. We all, on behalf of Sherburn County, I thank you for increasing the public utility class rate and the personal property. And finally, I want to acknowledge Senator Dibble's amendment on the rural preserves allocation issue. I identified that immediately as a problem with the previous conference committee and appreciate that that provision will be dropped. I do want to just identify a few concerns. The use deed issue, there have been a number of parties who have been meeting on that. The Department of Revenue has put together an amendment that recognizes the agreements that have been determined by those meetings, and hopefully at some point that can get incorporated into the bill. Finally, I just want to mention the public finance bill provisions, expanding the county capital improvement program to public works facilities, fiber optic cable, and fairgrounds was dropped from the bill. We'd hope at some point that would be reinstituted, as well as extending the county capital notes to other capital equipment has this authority that exists currently for cities. With that, I'll conclude. Be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Carlson, on the use deed issue, when are we going to see that language, and who is a party to the agreement?
Chairman, Senator Dibble, the department has put together the amendment that reflects the agreements that reflect almost, I'd say, 90% of the issues that were in discussion there. It addresses all the concerns that have been raised by the counties, to my knowledge, and most of the concerns, I believe, that have been raised by the cities. I think there is one outstanding issue there. I'm not sure that that's been stared by staff, but it certainly has been circulated by Mr. Nord with the Department of Revenue to the various parties, and if he has not shared it with staff, I'm sure he will be doing that shortly.
So, well. Well,
Senator Dibble, I expect we're going to have a conversation in the conference committee. I think last I heard there was still an issue with the city of St. Paul. Senator Waugh, is that right?
I'm not sure that is a problem. Senator Dibble, the use deed issue is not just in the tax committee, but it's got provisions in there that the Environment Policy Committee would like to look at because it affects DNR property and affects them, and then the Judiciary Policy Committee would like a chance to look at them. So what we did was, instead of trying to get the tax bill to go over there, I took those provisions and introduced them as a separate bill. But because we ultimately wanted to come back and incorporate it into the tax bill, we let the two committees do their work in order to meet the deadlines. And now that that work has been done, Senator Chaudhry wants to, he's going to be convening his committee to do a couple of confirmation hearings as well as I. And we'd like a chance to take a look at those provisions in those committees. I had been talking with Mr. Chair and with the department. What I would like to do is to take that bill to the committee and take the work that's been done on it thus far, do an author's amendment, have a chance for that work, so that as we work through those two processes, we get to conference on this bill, we will hopefully work out all the kinks and have everyone at the table. So it's not that it's not being done. A lot of work is being done on it, and we're just trying to provide a process so that everyone has input.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I serve on the Environment Policy Committee, so I'll have a
yes.
chance to see it there. I assume Senator Rest doesn't have an interest as a kind of a state and local issue, too. Not that I want to drag that bill around to too many places, but but it's a sticky wicket, and it you know, raises a lot of issues.
Mr. Peterson? Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Steve Peterson. I'm with Flaherty and Hood here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. I would first like to thank the members and the chairman for putting in two small parts of our larger land use bill in the halt of incorporations and the compact TIF districts. This was a part of two parts of a very large land use bill, and I'd like to thank the chairman and the many other members of the committee who helped work on that bill with all the stakeholders involved. We hope to move forward with that in the years to come so that when we when we put money into transportation, we also put it into reducing congestion, that we not only just spend money on cleaning up water, but we also stop the spoiling of it, and that when the members of this committee and the state look at reducing their greenhouse gas to meet their goals, that we can offset that the reductions from clean cars or lower fuel miles aren't offset with the growth of traveling in lane miles. Moving on, I'd like to move to the aids and credit portion of the bill, and I would like to thank the chair and members for putting forth a very fair bill to cities. Many people will look at this and say cities are not being cut in 2009, and this bill, of course, does not add to the cuts, but I'm here to tell you that cities are cutting today in 2009 due to the $66 million that was cut in the end of December of this year, last year. And I'd like to thank the members for recognizing that those cuts are occurring by not adding to further cuts in 2009. As for 2010 and beyond, the CGMC has never supported of LGA cuts. However, we do understand that this is a partnership with the state and that we do have to do our part to share in the pain of solving the budget deficit. And finally, I'd like to say there's been a lot of talk about jobs today and yesterday as far as this tax bill. And one of the things that this committee did was actually save a lot of jobs by not going the governor's route of cutting LGA to cities. These are jobs that that would have been lost if we would have gone that direction. Jobs in Park and Rec, which are our members, our residents of our citizens that work with our killed children at after care programs and mow the lawn so that they can play baseball. It's our librarians that work at our libraries that are busier than ever right now working on resume and helping people further their education. It's the street maintenance that fill the potholes that prevent a person driving of lower income who hits their car and dents their and friends at rim for spending thousands of dollars to fix that. And it's the people that are police and fire that are out there every day protecting us. I would like to thank the members for recognizing the services and the jobs that are provided by local government aid and remembering that that's more than just a paycheck to a family, but services to our fabrics of our community. Thank you.
Thank you. Patty Nauman and the League of Minnesota Cities. Is that you, Mr. Rourke? And Dave Engstrom.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jennifer O'Rourke with the League of Minnesota Cities, and first of all, I want to voice our respect to you and the members of your committee, as well as your staff, in the hard work that you've done thus far, and the incredible task you have as legislators in crafting a fix to this historic budget deficit. We certainly appreciate your concern and attention to the state-local fiscal partnership this year and the stability that offers us, especially with inclusion of removing the levy limits, the extension of the housing improvement areas and special service districts, utility classification changes of the emergency debt certificates that we brought forward as legislation. You certainly have our commitment to work with Senator Marty in making sure that the amendment he brought forward today actually works in the establishment of those housing improvement areas. And if I could just add the historic tax credit provision for that as well. I think you had some really good testimony last week when you were putting together the jobs portion of this bill. On the development side of the bill, I just want to voice some concerns that we'd hoped that the REST TIF housing pooling bill would have been included just to help deal with some of the foreclosure crises that are occurring in a lot of the neighborhoods. And then thank you for including Senator Dibble's amendment that we worked to scale back in your bill for today. It's hard to be as eloquent as Steve Peterson just was, but I'd just like to thank you in remembering the unallotment that we took in December when you were putting together your LGA and market value homestead credit cuts for this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I just want to echo some of what Ms. O'Rourke has just said, but first of all, to thank the chair and the committee for the hard work that they put into this bill in trying to address the state's fiscal challenges and the fiscal crisis that we are in. A couple of provisions I'd like to comment about the LGA and the market value homestead credit. We certainly don't like to see any kind of cuts, but we really do appreciate the recognition of the unallotment of LGA and market value homestead credits in 2008, in December of 2008. And that also the level of cuts that we do see in this bill are not as severe as we might have expected them to be, and we think that really reflects the commitment to maintaining a strong state and local fiscal partnership by the committee, and we appreciate that very much. I also want to express our appreciation for the repeal of levy limits in this bill and the allowance for cities to use emergency debt, and also the mandate relief around the elimination of truth in taxation hearing requirements. A couple pieces about the TIF too. TIF provisions, we are pleased that some of the TIF provisions we had wanted to see are in this bill, including the amendment today on the transit-oriented development, that provision. We're hoping, as well as the housing replacement provisions in the bill and the five-year rule extension for renewal and renovation districts. We are hoping that as the committee moves forward that it will be able to consider the pooling bill that Senator Rest had put forward that we had supported. And we hope that that can be considered by the bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Dave Engstrom, Minnesota Association of Small Cities, and being the, I think, nearly last of the municipal and county lobbyists, I won't repeat everything they said, but we'll tell you we do agree. You've had a very, very difficult task this year with the budget deficit. We knew we were going to be part of the solution, and we think this bill is very fair. We think it's very straightforward and fair, and the Minnesota Association of Small Cities thanks you for all your work. And on behalf of Green Isle, which I don't think is here today, I thank you on behalf of the City of Green Isle. You're helping them out of a pretty tough predicament that they're in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Members.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair, just maybe a quick question, and a lot of discussion on lifting the levy limits, and I was a former local public official, and I never liked those myself. But as we move forward now, we all know where we are in our communities and our state with respect to this recession. And do you have any thoughts in terms of the moods of the city, if you will, in terms of looking forward? And I think the cap, although there were some escape routes, was about 3.9% on levy limits. Do you have any sense of whether or not cities are generally going to be able to hold, certainly in that neighborhood?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sundrum, I can't think of any, every city that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, this is one of their number one issues, frankly. And I think Joe Matthews said it really well when he was up here at the desk. It's a lot, as city officials or county officials, when they don't have levy limits hanging over them in terms of their discussions and decisions, they can make more honest choices, I think, in terms of what their local budgets are going to look like. They're all elected just like you are and take that job pretty seriously.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's why.
Well, Senator Sundrum, I was very disappointed when the Department of Revenue published a number yesterday that because of the removal of levy limits, that cities were going to levy an additional $400 million in property taxes. And we're going to give the department an opportunity to tell us about what their assumptions were. I just don't believe that in these economic times, cities are just going to take the lid off of property taxes and stick it to our constituencies. I trust my locally elected officials. I believe they're closer to my constituents than I am, being here at the Capitol. And I just don't believe that they're going to do that. They understand the difficulties back in their communities, and I think if we're going to have a good relationship with cities, we have to trust each other. And I don't think the department helped things any yesterday when they, under some assumptions, indicate that cities are going to levy an additional $414 million because of the removal of levy limits. But we'll give the department an opportunity before we're done, I think, to explain the assumptions they made in that conclusion. Senator Resnick.
Well, Mr. Chairman, when I heard that that estimate, it occurred to me that if that indeed happened, that there would be a number of local government officials who would be enrolling in the witness protection program.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree with what you said. I talked to some of my city administrators after the unallotment, and they said that they suggested to their councils that they do levy more than what they did, and they are protectionists to their constituency. So I would agree with you that they're not going to go through the roof.
Senator Dibble?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest had a proposal to take a look at our fiscal notes and our revenue notes and have a process to make sure that they stand a certain test of objectivity and credibility. And Senator Rest, did you ever introduce that as a bill?
That was last year, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, and I think became part of Senator Cohen's bill on some government reforms and so on, and I think it got vetoed.
Mr. Chair, I have to say that I have never seen this year has been extraordinary in terms of the wild and, frankly, very easy to question fiscal notes and revenue notes. I've never seen fiscal notes and revenue notes that have been so far out of whack from any objective or credible analysis. And I have to just say for the record, it's become a great concern to a lot of people, a lot of legislators, a lot of folks who observe the process, and frankly people inside the agencies and the departments have privately articulated their concern about these revenue notes and these fiscal notes that are coming forward and the numbers that get put in them. I think I've been here 9 years now, I think we started seeing a creeping tendency in the last couple of years, and this year it's been worse than ever. And I think that's a shame when we can't rely on those documents, to as we're working through our policy and working through, having to pay for the ideas that we have and developing our budgets, how can we do our work here?
Senator Dibble, it's interesting. The issue surfaced in the newspaper. Department of Revenue didn't come to me with a number about the tax bill, but the memo is an email from Brian McClung in the governor's office to the Capitol Press Corps. That's how it got in the newspaper, and it seems pretty purely political, but we'll give the department an opportunity to come up and speak to it, because I have some questions about it myself. Senator Moi?
Mr. Chair, members, I have a number of bills that went through the Judiciary Budget Division and the Public Safety Division, where it incurred a pretty big fiscal note. And I don't know about other agencies and how they do their fiscal notes, but I have to say that a lot of our staff people at the agencies who help us to assess the fiscal impact work really hard, and session after session, when not just the Senate, but the legislature, and as we put our budget together, we've cut, and some of those cuts have been to staff positions, positions that do research and analysis and run the fiscal notes for us. And it is, I think, hard for, especially in a year like this year, when it is really critical and really important for us to get good information, to make good policy decisions. I think many of our agency staff who do the fiscal notes and who help do the analysis for us are all working really long hours and working really hard. And for the staff people that I've worked with on, you know, my other bills, and particularly at the Supreme Court and at public safety, they're more than willing to take a phone call and talk to me and explain why things are the way they are. And they're more than willing to say, I get what you're trying to do here, and yes, I can modify. Now that I understand what you're trying to do, I can modify the fiscal note. So I think that there is some, there may be some differences in people's responsiveness, but I also want to recognize that there's some people who are working awfully hard for all of us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I completely concur, and you know, my criticism is not among of agency staff that are working really hard to put together good faith estimates. I think I'm not getting in a lot of my fiscal and revenue notes, and I think a lot of my colleagues are not getting good faith estimates of what stuff is going to cost or what the projections are, and I'm concerned about that. And some of these notes have come so far out of whack that, you know, I would hope that we could get back to Senator Ress's proposal, just to make sure that there is some scrutiny and some objectivity, because we have to rely on that information, and it is supposed to be objective and not tinged with agendas or politics. And I've tried, you know, so Senator Ma, you have probably have a good relationship with the folks in the agencies that over which you have jurisdiction. I've tried, and I frankly get fairly political responses back.
Members, we've got a few more people to testify. Thank you, cities. Elizabeth Quam, Don Ostrom, and David Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, I have some handouts.
We'll get those distributed.
Mr. Chair and members of the Tax Committee, thank you for the opportunity to comment on the provider tax marker that is in your bill. I represent the Minnesota Ambulatory Healthcare Consortium, which we provide safe and lower cost alternatives for patients within ambulatory surgery and outpatient imaging centers. My employer is the Center for Diagnostic Imaging. I'm the volunteer executive vice president of Imaging for Cause Foundation, and I'm a former president and continue to be a board member of the Minnesota Rural Health Association.
Thanks.
Specifically with Mac's concerns, about just in case you end up going down the road of a provider tax as you begin to negotiate with the governor, I just hope you'll help your colleagues, legislative colleagues, understand that first and foremost, the tax that funds the Healthcare Access Fund is a tax on sick people. It is, always has been that. Secondly, it's an increase in the provider tax, whether it's to hospitals, surgical centers, or on directly on independent providers. It's still a direct tax increase for all the uninsured and soon-to-be uninsured Minnesotans at a time when we are experiencing the worst of economic times. As is the case since the Healthcare Access Fund was established, the majority of the uninsured and underinsured never have qualified for Minnesota Care. Many of these non-qualifiers are farmers and other self-employed individuals and small business owners and their employees. Once their temporary COBRA subsidy runs out, many other, especially Minnesotans living in the cities, will be in the same situation that most of Senator Skoy's